Anyhow, the books. Are you seeing the books? Everything you would want to read is right here. Feel it. Feels good, right? Now smell it. Nothing smells like that.
I'm sorry, excuse me. Did I just see you smell that book?
Dear Reader, Season 3, brought to you by the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Episode 8, Swords and Sandals. Greetings and salutations to the 8th episode of Dear Reader Season 3, a limited series looking at the Homeric epic, the Iliad, and its wide-ranging adaptations. I'm your guide to how to pierce bronze beneath the nipple and how to throw boulders at your enemy, Stella. I have already examined the source material over 2 episodes, so check out episodes 1 and 2, and have laid the foundation for the rest of the season as I determine whether an adaptation follows the spirit or law of the Iliad. While there are always secondary questions that I pose, and I want to continue examining whether Helen really is to blame for the Trojan War, in this episode, I will look at the story of Troy from an American cinematic lens, and also whether Troy tells the story of the Iraq War. As always, there is no continuity for the show, but you shouldn't miss episode 1 or 2, which will provide all of the context. And a special shout out to Arturo from Mexico, a Fire and Water Patreon subscriber who wished to be name dropped on my show rather than risk Apollo's wrath. Welcome and thank you. Well, I don't know how it has happened, but each season I've brought on this hanger on, this real no name, nobody. But he just likes to be on the show for some reason, and I like to give handouts from time to time. But he is my good friend. Sometimes I call him Beep Boop, but today we'll call him Harry. But yes, please welcome for the 3rd time out of 3 seasons, Mr. Harrison Shute.
Thank you. I swear I was going to use the handout line, but you beat me to it.
That you give me a handout, yeah, by blessing me with your presence?
Mm-hmm. Maybe it's best I don't.
Yeah, perhaps not. I will say, as a peek behind the curtain, that Harry was recently in Baltimore and we went to Baltimore Comic Con together, and he was selling his Martian Sun imprint, What Divine Anguish. There's your little payment. Nice. For coming on the show. And at one point, I don't know what day it was, but I turned to him because I think we were kind of talking about this. I turned to him and I said, or asked, what made you want to, you know, come on the show for this? And he looked at me blankly and had no response. And I just started cracking up. So I think that was my beginning to gaslight him in saying that it was his idea to have Troy, mm-hmm, be this episode and that he come on for Troy. But we'll see if he regrets it or not. It probably was my idea, but I like to think that it was his and that he wanted to be on for season 3.
Well, like a lot of men, I believe that having seen a movie once makes me an expert on that movie. So when I heard that you would be covering Troy somehow, yeah, I thought she would greatly benefit from, yeah, an expert opinion. So that can be our story.
Sounds lovely. Just like a man. What is your, just to give the setup and to see whether you really are worthy of being listened to, what, mm-hmm, is your knowledge of Homer's Iliad? Or at least, yeah, we'll go with the Iliad and then any background to the Trojan War.
Oh, okay. Well, my knowledge of, I suppose, both has always been based in cultural osmosis, to the point where I only learned from this very podcast that the Iliad ends with Hector's funeral rather than the Equestrian-themed Fall of Troy. Whenever students usually read the Iliad, we either did an abridged version or none at all. So I assume they figured a war story would simply be too interesting. And it's a shame because, like anyone else, I definitely had a Greek mythology phase. So it's too bad.
Yes, I think a lot of people assume that the Trojan horse is a part of the Iliad. I feel like before I read the Iliad in probably around 2012 in preparation for a shift in the AP Latin curriculum, I too thought that and thought, Virgil in the Aeneid is just kind of borrowing from that. But no, Virgil's going into way more post Hector's death than Homer does. And then what is your history with this film, though you may have already alluded to it?
I watched Troy over at a friend's house, likely around the time of its home video release, which is what made me surprised to learn that it's actually an R-rated movie because I would have been 11 or 12. And from that point on, it is remembered as a footnote in the production of a different film, which we will mention later.
Yeah, I remember this film fondly. I remember when it came out. I think my mom had seen it maybe, and she recommended it. I think I was either a junior or a senior in high school. And I remember quite randomly, the friend group that I went to with was not random. It was mostly like some marching band friends and then my best friend from high school. But we also brought our band director. I don't know how that came about. We were just like, hey, Mr.
What?
Caldwell. I know. Mr. Caldwell, do you want to go see Troy with us? I think it must have been maybe seniors. So you can kind of get away with more. I think your relationships with teachers, I think, can go in a safe way. Outside of school, but just because you're seniors and you're leaving. And I think you're trying to foster those bonds as much as possible before you head out. And we were all very close with him being in band since eighth or ninth grade. So yeah, I remember sitting in the theater and watching that, which is awkward once you've got some of the nudity and the sex scenes. You're like,
Yeah.
wow, there's an adult with us. But yeah, I remember before that, other friends talking about the presentation of Achilles and what a manly man he was, and his first scene with the two naked women, and yeah, all of this. So it has. I think I'll just always remember that. And then as I was teaching the Aeneid, and after you have the AP exam, which is usually the last exam in the first week, so you're finished by May 4th or 5th, and then what do you do with your class? And so I usually have some sort of fun final project, but also I show Troy, and of course you have to be very cautious. So I remember sending home the first time I wrote the permission slip. I think I said that I was going to take out some, or maybe some or most scenes of sensuality, and I remember getting an angry email from one of the parents saying like some like upset, like why. Not all. And I think I phrased it that way because there are scenes where Brad Pitt is naked and he is speaking to Briseis. And I think technically that's a scene of sensuality, but I think that it's he a lot of his scenes, I mean, what we can potentially argue, he has a lot of worthwhile things to say. And I think with those scenes in particular, with those two people and how they disagree with the war and how, what people are doing and what they're allowed to do in war and things like that. I'm not going to fast forward that scene. So just, because he is naked, you can't see anything anyways. It's like pelvis up. But that technically, so that's why I did that. And then I had to remake the permission form and say all scenes of, sexuality, which really is, the first one, which not much happens. It's just that there are naked women. And then Paris and Helen, and then Briseis and Achilles. But yeah, so I think all those three things are ingrained. So all that to say, also that I was watching it basically in the springtime every year for several years. And then it had been a while, I stopped teaching in, or pause, I should say, in 2020. So I hadn't seen it since then. So it's kind of a nice little refresher.
Nostalgia hit.
Absolutely. Okay, well, we're going to get into this. I jokingly said before I started recording that this episode might be, in fact, as long as Troy itself. So we've got some background into it. We have a retrospective from the words of Wolfgang Petersen looking back. And I've got three reviews that we'll look at and then the plot, and then we have our discussion. So yeah, buckle up your sandals and get ready. So Troy is a 2004 epic historical action film that is directed by Wolfgang Petersen and written by someone you should know or be familiar with, David Benioff. Produced by units in Malta, Mexico, and Britain's Shepperton Studios, the film is loosely based on Homer's Iliad in its narration of the entire story of the decade-long Trojan War, condensed into little more than a couple of weeks, rather than just the quarrel between Achilles and Agamemnon in the ninth year. Achilles leads his Myrmidons along with the rest of the Greek army invading the historic city of Troy, defended by Hector's Trojan army. The end of the film, which is, of course, the sack of Troy, is not taken from the Iliad, but rather from Quintus Smyrnaeus's Post-Homerica, as the Iliad concludes with Hector's death and funeral. I would also like to say, Virgil's Aeneid, I think, is there. Hopefully you didn't blink and miss Aeneas's cameo at the end. Did you get it?
Of course I did. He
Okay,
said, just
cool.
call us Shield.
He sure did, yeah. Carrying his aged father, Anchises. Always beautiful. Troy made over $497 million worldwide, making it the 60th highest grossing film at the time of its release. However, it received mixed reviews, with critics praising its entertainment value and the performances of Pitt and Bana, while criticizing its story, which was deemed unfaithful to the Iliad. It received a nomination for Best Costume Design at the 77th Academy Awards and was the eighth highest grossing film of 2004. So I think we need to discuss the context of this film, the historical context, in particular how it deals with Iraq. I first want to ask Harry, who is, I would say, I very much respect him and his knowledge of films, and I would consider you a cinephile. What was going on in American cinema around the time of Troy's filming and its release?
Yes. When I was looking into the production history, I couldn't find a whole lot, which is ironic because apparently there's a whole documentary about the production of the movie entitled Battles of Troy, directed by a fellow named Krasimir Terziev. Specifically, is about the hundreds of Bulgarian athletes hired to stand in as the armies. But the question I was looking in for an answer to was, why was this movie made, beginning with the script? And according to a 2012 Evening Standard review, which I think you have here, with Wolfgang Petersen, D of D&D was pitching a film adaptation of the Iliad to studios. But of course, by the time Petersen got involved, the movie would have already been in development. So Terry Gilliam and Christopher Nolan had turned it down. So it's just a look like it's weird that there's no that moment in its development history is not on record, I guess, at least to that I could find. My theory about why this movie was made is that Brad Pitt signed on in late 2002. He was training for 6 months, and that was only a few months after The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring won 4 Oscars out of 13 nominations, as well as more than $800 million at the box office. And that movie also, if you recall, happened to feature Sean Bean. And then before that, of course, there was Gladiator. And I think that that 1-2 punch kind of inspired a resurgence of the, as you say, sword and sandal epic, including movies like 2003's The Last Samurai, 2004's Alexander, and King Arthur, 2005's TV shows Rome, Empire, and the movie Kingdom of Heaven, which was also directed by Ridley Scott, like Gladiator, and ending, I think, terminating quite definitively in 2007 with 300. Hollywood executives love trends, but they must hate the expensive ones, and this one obviously very expensive. So that, to me, that's the cinema context behind this, is that there was a bunch of really successful sword and sandals movies kind of all at once, and Troy, to me, has always felt like a Me Too kind of movie.
Yeah, I think that that is more reasonable than the, we've got a war going on and let's try to create an allegory for it or use a well-known wartime story to compare what is going on contemporaneously. So I will talk though about, 'cause some people, in the cast as well as the director itself will say, or have said, I should say, in the past tense, that there is a connection to Iraq. So I'll at least read from their words and then kind of my thoughts on this, and then I would
Yes.
love to hear Harry's as well. So I yeah, had to do some digging for this. I will say I feel like I had more trouble researching for this 2004 than I had for some of the older films I was doing for like Jane Eyre and The Women. I think partially because AFI stops at a certain date, so I couldn't use that to look up, and they always have great reviews, and I can look up in the Wayback Machine and find reviews. But yeah, I could not. It was like the internet was dead
It's
in
weird.
2004. So this comes from the Sunday Times, which is a British publication, and it was published on May 14th, 2004. Again, I'm just snipping some pieces here. Speaking before the premiere of Troy at the Cannes Film Festival, he said, he being Brad Pitt, so I should have said that, "You cannot watch an historic story without being informed about what we're going through now. We're all after the same thing. It's this greater idea of a common humanity, and how do we get past these hatreds and resentments that have built between us?" Saffron Burrows, his British co-star who plays Andromache, said, "What is interesting about Troy is the eternal question of the futility of war, the weariness of war. There is a terrible sense of deja vu in what the Trojan faced and what we're facing now." And Wolfgang Peterson also drew parallels to Iraq, though it was most likely at the forefront of his mind since it directly impacted his production. This was from a Times article that published on May 10th, 2004. The invented Troy, surrounded by a wall 40 feet by 500 feet, made from 200 tons of plaster, was to be built in Morocco. But shortly before shooting started, the location had to be switched. The war in Iraq, says Peterson with a shrug, there. Could you imagine that? There were concerns about terrorism in the area, so we go to Mexico. And then my final thing, which was a writing for Pathos, and this is written by Jeremy Purves, and it was called Troy Peterson 2004, 10 Years Later, Part One. A number of critics seem to want Troy to be an allegory for the war in Iraq. Johannesson, flick philosopher, wrote that Agamemnon here is basically the W, which I was looking at this word because that's a quote. It's spelled capital DUBYA. And I thought, I have no idea what this is. Is this in the Middle East? And I looked it up and like, how do you pronounce this? And the pronunciation was W. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is President Bush. I can't believe that it's worded that way. But anyways, here, so Agamemnon is President Bush of his day. Helen is his WMDs, his weapons of mass destruction, though of course she does actually exist, so there's a lot of biting in here. And Achilles, his Halliburton contractor cough, mercenary cough. David Edelstein from Slate Magazine is also thinking of President Bush when he writes that, quote, "Agamemnon sends men off to kill and be killed to serve a grotesquely private power mad agenda, something to do with making a show of his might to scare the whole world into submission. Truly a Troy for our time," end quote. The film is, quote, "a topical treatise on what happens when soldiers blindly follow their leaders into war," wrote Brunson from Creative Loafing. "It can't just be a coincidence that his Iliad adaptation is full of exchanges that dwell upon the reasons that nations elect to go to war, as well as the toll that such battles inflict upon everyone involved."
Surely not.
Certainly, there are numerous lines that could easily be applied to the White House war hawks, the mess they've created in Iraq, and the soldiers that are being sacrificed to further their own insidious agendas. John R. McEwen from Film Quip summarized the plot as a, quote, "selfish and petty political leader takes his country to war for spite, sending thousands to die so that he may gain power, put his name in the history books, and settle some silly score between him and another ruler." Geez, that's exactly what's going on right now! Exclamation point and end quote. I do wonder if the timeline might not 100% match up. I was looking like, when is the official start of the Iraq War? And that was March 20, 2003. Production, began in April 2003. I feel like pre-production would have begun before that, and writing. But even if you say, oh, maybe there is some overlap, I think the same thematic connections could really be made between the Iliad and any war.
Yes.
And we saw that, when Tom was on this show, we saw that with some productions of Shakespeare's Troilus and Cressida, they were also making similar connections to contemporary wars and trying to apply that and put that sort of glaze or gloss over it and perhaps what the production looked like and things like that. So I think it's maybe convenient because that was happening and this war came out, but I don't know if there was an intentionality when things started to be like, hey, let us try to really resonate with what's going on in the Iraq War. That's my opinion anyways. What do you think?
Yeah, I would agree. I think as a critic at that time, it would be impossible to resist the temptation to make the connection, especially since so much of, film academia or a strong tradition in film criticism is to talk about like how the Vietnam War influenced so many movies in the 70s and 80s, from like unexpected places to like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Like that's all over the books. And so in this case, it's like, well, what's that for our generation? Oh, there happens to be a war going on right now,
Yeah.
and there's not a lot to talk about with this movie anyway. I find this to be actually deeply silly. Like, I don't even know how the narrative of the Iraq War would map onto this one. And granted, our understanding of the Iraq War in 2004 was imperfect and incomplete, and perhaps it is still now, but I think back then it was, I mean, when you're saying that, like, Helen is WMDs, like, that's just such an absurd thing to say that
Yeah.
you got to be able to back up and look at that objectively.
Yeah, I mean, one could, look at because there's a really a powerful and terrible line that Agamemnon says near the end of the film, like the last 90%, that he would send 400,000 Greeks to die if it meant that, they could pull down the wall of Troy. And I could be like, oh, that's the Vietnam War right there. We just sent
The big
so
grinder.
many people and nothing was working, but we've got this cause against communism, so we're just gonna keep throwing people at it. So I feel like it could just be that connection can be made between the Iliad and any war, which was, one of my great points, I think, when I started analyzing that work, that I think it has lived on so long because it does resonate, quite sadly, because we keep having wars. But I think it is such an origin point, I think, for wartime literature and like this, films and other thought pieces on war. Okay. Well, let's get into, I guess, the creation of it, because I didn't mention it before. I'll mention it again, but it is directed by Wolfgang Petersen, screenplay by David Benioff, of course, based on the Iliad by Homer and Post-Homerica by Quintus Myrnaeus, produced by Wolfgang Petersen, Diana Rathbun, and Colin Wilson. Cinematography by Roger Pratt, edited by Peter Honus, music by James Horner, production companies Warner Brothers Productions, Radiant Productions, Plan B Entertainment, Helena Productions, which I find amusing, Latina Pictures, and Nemar Studios. Release dates: May 13th, 2004 at Cannes, and then May 14th, 2004 in the United States. Its running time is 163 minutes theatrical and 196 minutes director's cut. Harry and I both watched the theatrical. I think whether I knew or I had forgotten the director's cut, Harry told me about it, and I was like, oh. And I'm not really going to talk about it, but I will say that they extend the battle scenes. I think they do make it more gruesome, which I think when you're doing war films, I think that you don't need to be gratuitous about it, but I think you need to show what war is actually like, and I appreciate that. And the book itself, the work itself is rather gruesome, and some of the sex scenes are extended. I remember seeing a
Awesome.
quote that I kind of scoffed at of, to show more nudity with Diane Kruger. I was like, okay, yeah, because that's worth it. And then an extended Achilles and Briseis sex scene. Maybe at one point I'll see what this is to see what if it's worth it or not, but. You and I constantly talk about whether run times are too long. Did you think that this film, the theatrical cut, was too long?
I did.
Okay. And he'll stop right there. He can tell me why later.
No, I am a man of brevity.
I appreciate that. Its budget was between 175 and 185 million. And of course, as I mentioned before, its box office take was 497.4 million.
Bit
The cast is
disappointing.
as follows: Brad Pitt as Achilles, Eric Bana as Hector, Orlando Bloom as Paris, Diane Kruger as Helen, Brian Cox as Agamemnon, Sean Bean as Odysseus, and yes, he does survive. Brendan Gleeson as Menelaus, Rose Byrne as Briseis, Peter O'Toole as Priam, Garrett Hedlund as Patroclus, which I forgot about him, Saffron Burrows as Andromache, Julie Christie as Thetis, John Shrapnel as Nestor, Nigel Terry as
Archaeopteryx.
Archipptolemaeus, James Cosmo as Glaucus, Julian Glover as Triopas, Vincent Reagan as Eudorus, Trevor Eve as Velior, Tyler Mayne as Ajax.
Sabretooth.
Yeah, I was going to say, isn't that Sabretooth? And then Nathan Jones as Boagrius.
He was the
Okay.
Juggernaut, right? Maybe not.
Oh, you'll have to look as I'm reading other things.
Yeah.
So I'm going to look at some of the production. A lot of this is taken from the Wikipedia, and then I also found a retrospective from. Oh shoot, where did this come from? Oh, I think it was Hollywood Reporter. It was reported on by Yolanda Desta on May 14th, 2019, and it's really talking to Wolfgang Peterson, and I find it really informative, especially because you're looking back 10 years. You know, you can potentially be free enough from it or enough distance that I think you can speak truthfully. Though I guess we can decide whether he is also speaking with resentment. But we did talk about the city of Troy being built. Well, originally it's supposed to, start in Morocco, and then it was forced to move. Other important scenes were shot in, wow, I should have done some research here, Melilla, a small town in the north of Malta, and on the small island of Comino. The outer walls of Troy were built and filmed in Cabo San Lucas, Mexico. Film production was disrupted for a period after Hurricane Marty affected filming areas, and Pitt also suffered an injury to his, get this, Achilles tendon during
Boo.
filming, which caused the production to delay for several weeks. Terry Gilliam turned down the offer to direct the film as he, quote, did not understand how you can make a film based on the poem The Iliad without the participation of the Greek gods, end quote. And I will be asking that question, in fact. Christopher Nolan was then offered to direct the film, as Harry mentioned, but turned it down and chose to direct Batman Begins instead.
Big mistake.
Wolfgang Peterson was hired afterwards. The role of Briseis was initially offered to Bollywood actress Aishwarya Rai, but she turned it down because she was not comfortable doing the lovemaking scenes that were included. And Keira Knightley, which I find also ironic because Rose Byrne played Keira Knightley's, wait, Rose Byrne and Keira Knightley played the bodyguards of
Padme,
Padme, yes.
yeah.
Also auditioned, but the role was eventually went to Rose Byrne, and the studio was initially interested in Nicole Kidman for the role of Helen, which eventually went to Diane Kruger. So let's look at this interview here. So it's called Troy, the Secret Impact of Brad Pitt's Sword and Sandal Epic. I like how Brad Pitt is the one who is associated with this. 15 years ago today, Troy, Warner Brothers' massive blockbuster rendering of the Iliad, hit theaters. Directed by Oscar-nominated Das Boot helmer Wolfgang Peterson and written by industry newcomer David Benioff, who would co-create Game of Thrones a few years later. Troy was a sword and sandal epic that grossed $497.4 million worldwide, despite somewhat middling reviews and criticism of its loose devotion to Homer's original text. In terms of filmmaking, it was a Goliath feat. Peterson shot on location in Malta and Cabo San Lucas, commanding a handful of the industry's biggest stars, including Brad Pitt, Peter O'Toole, Julie Christie, and Lord of the Rings alums Orlando Bloom and Sean Bean. Thousands of extras and ever-present paparazzi who captured a now treasured photo of Pitt chatting on a cell phone while wearing full ancient Greek attire. Though the reviews were tepid at best, Troy had a lot going for it, including strong performances from O'Toole and Eric Bana, impressive fight scenes, and on a more superficial level, a dazzling array of impossibly good-looking stars. Looking back, the film also feels deeply like a proto Game of Thrones. Benioff's first go at adapting a fantastical narrative packed with high-stakes politics and shocking deaths. Two of Troy's stars, Bean and James Cosmo, would go on to star in the HBO juggernaut as well. The film also is a classic, surprisingly overlooked study in all the ways a big budget Hollywood picture can erupt behind the scenes, and the experience of making an Oddies movie with stars at the height of their box office power. It almost didn't even happen, in part because Peterson, then Warner Brothers' go-to guy, thanks to big budget hits like The Perfect Storm, had his eye on a very different movie, Batman versus Superman. My gosh, remember how long that was supposed to come out? Remember how that was the marquee in I Am
I am
Legend?
Legend.
Oh, then studio chief Alan Horn was interested in Peterson's take on the superhero story long before the DC Extended Universe and MCU came to dominate Hollywood. But after Peterson met with Benioff, who had only one other film under his belt at the time, the Spike Lee-directed 25th Hour, the two clicked. Peterson was forced to choose between Batman v Superman and Troy, a film that was itself being dangled to Christopher Nolan, who had already made well-received films like Insomnia and Memento, but had not yet become a household name. Nobody really knew him at that time, Peterson said in a recent phone interview with Vanity Fair. Oh, there you go. It's Vanity Fair. Apologies. Though, to be fair, Memento did make Nolan a breakout star. And though it sounds unbelievable now, there was reportedly hesitation over whether Nolan would be better than Peterson to handle a film of Troy's scale. Well, it's interesting reading this now, knowing that this is Stella speaking, knowing that Nolan is about to take on the Odyssey. So this is rather apropos. So we're back to this now. So Peterson went for Troy while Warner Brothers shelved Batman v Superman entirely, instead offering Nolan a fresh take on a solo Batman movie, which became Batman Begins. Thank God he did Batman, Peterson said with a laugh. Maybe fate helped out here. Uh-huh. The first issue was that Brad Pitt didn't look like Brad Pitt. I was shocked when I saw him, Peterson said. Pitt had expressed interest in playing Achilles, the golden warrior who leads the fight against Troy, and was meeting with Peterson at a German restaurant about the part. But at the time, he had a long beard and long dark hair and had lost weight in preparation for another movie that never came to fruition. I said, Jesus Christ, that's not how Achilles looks, Peterson remembered, but Pitt understood his worries. Over several beers, he promised Peterson that he would look like the Hollywood version of Achilles once more, reed, buff, and blonde, by the time the film was ready to shoot. And he kept that promise, shearing off the beard and working out religiously over the next 6 months to get into Greek god shape. The rest of the cast was rounded out by Aussie Eric Bana as Noble Prince Hector, Bloom as his cowardly brother Paris, and Bean as Achilles' heroic counselor, Odysseus. In regards to Nicole Kidman, I know Nicole very well. She's great, but she's a movie star, which is to say, he wanted the role to be played by a newcomer, which would both surprise a global audience and play on the mythical aspect of the character, speaking about Helen. Peterson auditioned thousands of hopefuls before finding then-unknown German actor Diane Kruger, who auditioned for in London. We did a test and she was so sweet and so nervous and so wonderful. Peterson said, I showed the tape to Alan and he said, okay, you got it. So the cast was assembled and sent to shoot in Malta. The location was beautiful, came with a much needed tax break. Of course, everyone's all about that. It was also swelteringly hot and, you know, word spread about the movie stars. Basically, half of the city was there and we all walked together back to the car. They were surrounding us. It was unbelievable. Of course, at that point in time in the mid-aughts, Brad Pitt, well, he's an attractive guy and he just graduated to heartthrob status. But Peterson wasn't prepared for the ever-stalking paparazzi who ran loud, buzzing helicopters over the set to get photos of Pitt, ruining production with their noise. Welcome to my world, Peterson remembered Pitt telling him. He felt so bad because what can you do? The paps found them even when production moved to a tiny cluster of islands where they shot those photos of Pitt talking on his phone. Oh, yeah, this is what you were mentioning here. So other scenes were filmed in Cabo San Lucas, Mexico. Marine biologists had to be on hand to make sure productions didn't damage the area's endangered turtle population. Uh-huh. During a major fight scene with 4,000 extras, about 2,000 of whom were trained Bulgarian athletes, several performers fainted due to the heat. They could have used the mayor there to help them out, have a little tent with an ice bath. Talked about the inclement weather before. The wall was real, wasn't CGI, cost about $1 million to build. And then, unfortunately, the set had to be abandoned with this hurricane that was approaching them. The hurricane destroyed the whole thing. These huge tents where all these costumes were in and props and all that, it just disappeared, basically flew into the air. The wall was reduced to dust and metal. The studio had no choice but to let the cast off while the crew rebuilt and making another wall. And that's when Pitt injured his Achilles tendon, postponing shooting even more. He can't imagine what that cost. I wonder what he was doing. The film's $175 million price tag may seem quaint compared to contemporary franchise movies, but at the time, the film's ballooning budget was a hot topic in the press. Circumstances seemed to conspire against the production. Once the crew was able to return to Cabo, for example, it's December, which meant the sun was going down earlier, which meant the natural lighting looks completely different than it had during the first shoot. Peterson had to devote part of his CG budget to getting long shadows taken out of basically every single shot. When Troy was finally released, it was maligned by many critics, as well as Iliad readers who disliked Benioff and Peterson's diversions from Homer's story, the most egregious of which is perhaps turning Patroclus, whom some readers view as Achilles' lover, into the hero's beloved cousin. Then and now, that decision reads as a classic studio hand-wringing over the portrayal of openly gay characters in a big-budget action movie. It never came up, Peterson said, of the possibility of including a gay storyline. Nowadays, it would be a different time and a different situation. But then it was not even a discussion. The movie also made the classic Hollywood choice to let every actor speak, for the most part, in their own native accent, save for Byrne and Banna, who switched their Aussie inflections for English ones. Peterson tried to get O'Toole to ease up on his posh, classically trained British accent, but that effort failed. Peter O'Toole didn't care, Peterson said, laughing. Even in Troy, he talks like that. Kruger said that O'Toole was sometimes drunk on set and wasn't the most pleasant actor to work with. Peterson apparently had no idea about this. On a movie like that, as a director, you're so involved in so many things that what really happened behind the scenes, if you're not really right there to see it and witness that, you don't know. But yeah, regardless of its many behind-the-scenes troubles, Troy went on to become Peterson's biggest box office hit, grossing nearly $500 million worldwide. It was the final installment in a string of undisputed hits that had begun with In the Line of Fire in 1993 for Peterson. And after Troy, the studio asked Peterson to lend his Midas touch to Poseidon, which that flopped for sure, which was a remake. I do recommend the original one. Yeah, I fell off the cliff finally, and that is also good, Peterson said. It has to happen, otherwise you go a little crazy, as he was talking about. Any thoughts on his retrospective?
Definitely some resentment, as you were saying. And this definitely reminds one of the making of Apocalypse Now, just in terms of making a huge. I mean, I think that that movie's kind of like the go-to example for a big production where everything goes wrong and the director kind of goes a bit mad. Obviously, Francis Ford Coppola is mad. This guy seems more even-keeled. But it also reminds me of things like Waterworld and Heaven's Gate. So it's kind of a success story. When I look at those numbers, like half a billion against like $200 million, that today would read as a failure. That's like Pacific Rim 2 numbers. So I don't know where they're getting off calling it another hit. Who
Yeah.
knows?
It is one of the, yeah, as I already mentioned, the highest grossing films of 2004. It was, which is alongside The Passion of the Christ, Spider-Man 2, and Shrek 2.
Great time for movies.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, so critical reception. So we're nearly there. On Rotten Tomatoes, Troy holds an approval rating of 53% based on 229 reviews, but with an average rating of 6 out of 10. The site's critics' consensus reads, I wonder if AI does an overview of that, a
Yay.
brawny, entertaining spectacle, but lacking emotional resonance. On Metacritic, the film has a weighted average score of 56 out of 100 based on 43 critics, indicating mixed or average reviews. And audiences polled by CinemaScore gave the film an average grade of B on an A plus to F scale. Roger Ebert rated the film 2 out of 4 stars, saying Pitt is modern, nuanced, introspective. He brings complexity to a role where it is not required. Apparently, so two people from IGN, Christopher Monfette and Cindy White, say that the director's cut is the superior version. 8 out of 10. Wow, I
The
guess I should.
classic
Yeah.
IGN movie score.
Indeed. The last thing I think I'll say from this, and then I'll do my three full reviews. Peter O'Toole, this is interesting, who played Priam, spoke negatively of the film during an appearance at the Savannah Film Festival, stating he walked out of the film 15 minutes into a screening and criticized the director, slamming him as a clown.
Wow.
Years later, Brad Pitt expressed, this is what I spoke to Harry about this, expressed disappointment with the film, saying, quote, "I had to do Troy because I pulled out of another movie and then had to do something for the studio. So I was put in Troy. It wasn't painful, but I realized that the way the movie was being told was not how I wanted it to be. I made my own mistakes in it. What am I trying to say about Troy? I could not get out of the middle of the frame. It was driving me crazy. I'd become spoiled working with David Fincher. It's no slight on Wolfgang Peterson. Das Boot is one of the all-time great films. But somewhere in it, Troy became a commercial kind of thing. Every shot was like, here's the hero. There was no mystery. End quote. I've seen that before. It was interesting. I don't know if my algorithm was popping up, but I think twice I had seen this on Instagram and was thinking a lot about that. And you had mentioned maybe he had left Tree of Life. Is that the one we were talking about?
The fountain. He was in
The
the Tree of
Fountain.
Life.
That's right. Sorry. That's my confusion. They're both like surrealist. But it's also interesting because his perception of reality and what he just said right there is very different than their meeting over beers that Wolfgang Petersen has said. And also, I don't know that, and this is something we can discuss, that every shot, here's the hero. I mean, I definitely see every shot that he was in it, like he's definitely a lead, but I would not necessarily categorize him as the hero of this film. What are your thoughts on that particular quote?
I would agree with you. He's just sort of speaking, extemporaneously, but that also hit my ear wrong because, especially in the first half, maybe three quarters of the movie, he's the villain. But I guess I understand what he's saying. And he worked with a lot of great directors in the 90s and the early 2000s, not only David Fincher, but also Terry Gilliam in 12 Monkeys, which gave him maybe his best career best performance. So it's just interesting, kind of a surprisingly grounded perspective to take, I'd say.
My favorite Brad Pitt film is Meet Joe Black.
Well, Moneyball for me.
Oh yeah, I also like Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
No comment.
Okay, so I have three reviews, and then we're going to get into it after the plot. So
Okay.
this first one is from Rolling Stone. 3 stars out of 5. This was written by Peter Travers, May 14th, 2004. And there are no paragraph breaks, so boy, I hope I don't lose my spot. So what if Troy falls short of its good intentions to pave the road to buffo glory with art? You are not going to resist a gladiator-size epic with studly guys, led by Brad Pitt, buffed to steroidal splendor as Achilles. Man, the alliteration. Playing a game of my dick is bigger than yours by going to war over a babe. Okay, the story is direct from Homer, with attendant reminders of slogging through the Iliad in its lit class. But Troy, besides being tremendously entertaining, is the best crib sheet guide to Homer ever. Director Wolfgang Petersen rips and roars through the tale, filling the screen with all the action of a 200 million budget can buy. In battle scenes, Petersen whips his computers into a frenzy, making 1,000 extras and soldier drag look like 50,000, each with a mean hair up his butt. This really is Rolling Stone. These Troy boys may wear sissy sandals, but they can stick in a sword and gut an opponent with enough artery piercing, entrail twisting brio to earn an R rating. You know the story. Paris, the haughty prince of Troy, runs off with Helen, the haughty wife of the Greek king Menelaus. Royally pissed off, the king and his brother Agamemnon launch 1,000 ships, again with computer magic, and steam off to Troy. The combat scenes, with soldiers rushing toward one another, brandishing weapons heavy with phallic symbology, have a visceral pow. What of characters, say you, who are not content with rousing popcorn movie buttered with testosterone? Here we hit a snag. At first, Pitt seems to be the film's Achilles heel. Removing his helmet, he shakes out a head of lush hair gleaming with blonde highlights as if to say, "Hi, I'm Achilles for Garnier Fructis." The shampoo ad glamour, not to mention bare ass sex scenes with a temple virgin, Perseus, wimps out a harsh character. Achilles, a mercenary hired by the Greeks, is haunted by demons. Pitt gathers momentum after the script stops saddling him with Braveheart lines. Immortality, take it. It's yours. Then don't exactly trip off his surfer dude tongue. It's also no help to Pitt that the cast consists of classically trained, mostly British actors, including the legendary Peter O'Toole as King Priam of Troy. Bloom bravely risks his it boy career as Lord of the Rings hero by correctly playing Paris as a callow weakling whose great love for Helen has the depth of a wading pool. One of the film's highlights has Paris foolishly taking on Menelaus in hand-to-hand combat and then crawling to safety at the feet of his older brother, Hector. Public shame adds character to the young prince, and Bloom acutely registers the change. Bana, the Aussie actor who is so good in Chopper and so lost in the Hulk, I've never heard of Chopper, gives the film's strongest performance, nailing the nobility in Hector without making him a paragon of dull virtue. At 2 hours and 43 minutes, Troy can drift into talky torpor as countless subplots are juggled. But when Peterson gets the action going in the final third, with Achilles and Hector in a killer duel and the Greek sneak attack inside the 38-foot-high Trojan horse, the soldiers snake out of the sea biscuits, wooden belly, and neck to tear up the town, the excitement doesn't quit. Troy lacks the focus of Gladiator, not to mention that Oscar winner's scrappy wit. But why kick a gift horse when you're in summer movie heaven?
Cocaine's a hell of a drug, kids.
Yeah. Next from the New York Times. Thank you to Harry for the gift article. Greeks Bearing Immortality is the title. And this is written by A.O. Scott and published on May 14th, 2004. This war will never be forgotten, nor will the heroes who fight in it. This line of dialogue expresses a thought that recurs frequently, with various inflections and in the mouths of various heroes over the nearly 2.5 hours of Wolfgang Peterson's Troy, which had its world premiere here last night and opens nationwide in the United States today. In one sense, it is less a prophecy than a statement of the obvious, since the names of Achilles, Hector, Odysseus, and the rest have endured for 3,000 years. At the same time, though, the endless talk of immortality seems to express the picture's anxious, naive ambition, which is to rise above the welter of summer blockbusters and ascend into the pantheon of movie classics. This is most unlikely. Troy, which cost something approaching the gross national product of modern Greece, oh boy, will be lucky to survive the arrival of Shrek 2 on Wednesday. But for what it is, a big, expensive, occasionally campy action movie full of well-known actors speaking in well-rounded accents, Troy is not bad. It has the blocky, earnest integrity of a classic comic book and labors to respect the strangeness and grandeur of its classical sources. Some moments may make you rue the existence of cinema, or at least of movies with sound, since the dialogue often competes with James Horner's score for puffed up obviousness. But there are others: crisply edited combat sequences, tableaus of antique splendor, a hugely muscled Brad Pitt modeling the latest in Hellenic leisure wear that remind you why you like movies in the first place. From its opening scenes, Troy, freely adapted by David Benioff from the Iliad and other sources, plunges you into a world shaped by complex codes of honor, loyalty, and military virtue. Or rather, it plunges you into a world where people talk about such things incessantly, and where every speech is punctuated by booming timpani and the ululations of an apparently tongueless female singer, her inarticulate moans announcing that this is not just a movie, but an epic. I wonder what this person would say about Dune Part 2. Still, for once, there really is a solid epic architecture underneath all the pageantry and not just a very long movie set in the distant past. Mr. Benioff's script, for all its line by line and infelicities, shows a real fascination with Homer's great characters and with the nexus of divided loyalties and competing ambitions that led to so much death and destruction. Unlike movies that take war as a simple contest of good and evil, Troy remains faithful to Homer and to human nature by understanding war as a political event with plenty of viciousness and virtue to go around. Like his screenplay for Spike Lee's 25th Hour, based on his own novel, Troy is fundamentally a story about treachery and brotherhood, about the fallibility and fragile nobility of men. In other words, it was not all Helen's fault, which is interesting phrasing. Not all Helen's fault, so Helen was to blame. So, of course, we're going to talk about that. Helen, played by Diane Kruger, a German model, is perfectly lovely, and it is easy to see why she prefers the boyish Paris to grouchy Menelaus, the ruler of Sparta. But their puppyish romance is a trivial pretext for the war rather than its true cause. Menelaus's jealousy is exploited by his brother Agamemnon, who uses the insult to further his imperial ambitions. His chief weapon is the sullen Achilles, who, in an earlier scene, strolls out of his love tent like a petulant movie star summoned from his trailer to dispatch an enormous Thessalonian warrior with a single stroke of his sword. Achilles' temperament, a volatile mixture of vanity, cynicism, and sentimentality, is the key to the movie, and Mr. Pitt attacks the role with the same vigor and agility the character demonstrates in combat. Yes, his accent sounds a bit like Madonna's, perhaps in deference to the mostly English and Australian actors who make up most of the cast, but for once he does not seem embarrassed by his charisma or driven to subvert it with actorish tics. Achilles' narcissism is like that of a modern celebrity. He fights because it will bring him fame, not to serve the gods or the glory of the Greek nation, or least of all his corrupt king. His true loyalty is to individuals, his beloved cousin Patroclus, his ruthless Myrmidons, and his love interest, the captured Trojan priestess Briseis, rather than to causes. His Trojan counterpart is Paris's brother Hector, who is constrained by the bonds of kingship, duty, and patriotism that Achilles disdains. If Achilles is a kind of existentialist rock star, Hector is a stoical family man, protective of his wayward brother, respectful of his father Priam, and devoted to his wife Andromache and their infant son, who was never named, I think, as DNX. The events leading up to Hector's duel with Achilles, a tempest of failure, deceit, and unappeasable emotion, are the beating heart of Homer's poem, and the filmmakers approach them with respectful sobriety, even going so far as to lower the volume on Mr. Herner's music. Mr. Banna, after his tentative superhero turn in The Hulk, shows more confidence here. His brooding, bearded countenance plays against Mr. Pitt's gleaming blondness, and the visual contrast emphasizes the differences between the characters. Meanwhile, you can savor generational contrast and acting styles whenever Mr. Cox or Mr. O'Toole appears on screen. Mr. O'Toole, frail and pale-eyed, quavers and whispers his way through the movie with regal panache and with that sly knack common among British actors of a certain age for seeming utterly aloof from the movie and at the same time utterly committed to it. Mr. Cox, for his part, never misses an opportunity to toss his impressive hair extensions and bellow like a beast of prey. If Odysseus had at thought of the Trojan horse, this Agamemnon would have chewed through the walls of Troy all by himself. Whether Troy will spur a revival of Hollywood interest in ancient literature remains to be seen, but the Greek and Roman canon is full of franchise potential, since it consists mainly of sequels, prequels, and spinoffs. Some are signaled near the end of Mr. Peterson's film as the Greeks overrun the city. What's your name, kid? Aeneas? Here, take this sword and go found another city somewhere else. Penelope? Yeah, it's Odysseus. Yeah, bad connection. Listen, I'll be home soon. Who were you just talking to? That was literally in that review. One notable sequel, however, has been foreclosed by a killing that is certainly merited, but that will nonetheless be surprising to scholars. I won't spoil it, but if I were Aeschylus, I'd call my agent. Oh, and I guess I just had two reviews. So I was thinking I had three.
That was a really long review.
That was a really long review. I thought I had another one. Well, anyways.
Nope.
Yeah, that's fine, I guess. Unless you did you
You're
delete
wrong.
Something? I guess I am wrong.
Yeah, that's like, let's get this moving, people.
I'm so sorry. Yeah, I know. See, I warned him. Listen, friends, listeners, I did say to him, there's a lot of reading. Do you want me to record this when you're not on? I gave him that opportunity and he said, no, I'd like to see how the show goes down. So whatever just happened is that's on him because I gave him the opportunity.
How am I going to get my comments in edgewise?
Yeah, I guess so. Okay, so let's do the plot. Is the plot long? About as long as that review. And then I think is a spoiler at the end and we can talk about that. Did you understand the reference?
No, I can't think of what he's talking about.
Oh, Agamemnon getting killed.
Oh, okay.
Because that, well, it would have been Electra. So because he comes home and then his wife, Clytemnestra, kills him. Yeah. So it was very shocking. Anywho, in 1184 BC, King Agamemnon unites the Greek kingdoms. Achilles, a heroic warrior, fights for Agamemnon, but despises his tyrannical rule. Meanwhile, Prince Hector of Troy and his brother Paris negotiate a peace treaty with Menelaus, king of Sparta. Paris begins an affair with Menelaus's wife, Queen Helen, and he smuggles her aboard his homebound vessel. Angered, Menelaus meets Agamemnon, his elder brother, and asks him to help take Troy. Agamemnon agrees, as conquering Troy would give him control of the Aegean Sea. Agamemnon sends Odysseus, king of Ithaca, to persuade Achilles to join them. Conflicted, Achilles seeks guidance from his mother, Thetis, who tells him that if he remains in Larissa, he will live a peaceful but forgotten life, while going to Troy will bring him eternal glory. Inspired by her words and the promise of lasting fame, Achilles chooses to join the war. You remember that sad kid at the very beginning where he's like, I'd be too scared to fight. And Achilles said, that's why you'll never be, you know, remembered.
Yeah.
I was like, that's so sad to tell a child. In Troy, King Priam welcomes Helen when Hector and Paris return home and decides to prepare for war. The Greeks eventually invade and take the Trojan beach, thanks largely to Achilles and his Myrmidons. Achilles has the temple of Apollo sacked and claims Briseis, a priestess and the cousin of Paris and Hector, as a prisoner. He is angered when Agamemnon spitefully takes her from him and decides that he will not aid Agamemnon in the siege. I will say that Briseis is not actually their cousin, so I can insert some things here. The Trojan and Greek army in the film, yes, but just to be clear, but in the original, not. The Trojan and Greek armies meet outside of Troy. During a parley, Paris offers to personally duel Menelaus in exchange for Helen and the city being spared. Agamemnon, intending to take the city regardless, accepts. Menelaus wounds Paris and almost kills him, but is himself killed by Hector, violating the duel. That also didn't happen. In the ensuing battle, Hector kills Ajax, and many Greek soldiers die due to Hector's skillful leadership of the Trojan army, which forces Agamemnon's army to retreat. Also, Ajax wasn't killed by Hector. I can give you all the inside stuff. He gives Briseis to the Greek soldiers for their amusement, but Achilles saves her, and they begin to bond. Oh! Later that night, Briseis sneaks into Achilles' quarters to kill him. I feel like she was already there. Instead, she falls for him and they become lovers. Achilles then resolves to leave Troy, much to the dismay of Patroclus, his cousin and protege. Despite Hector's objections, Priam orders him to attack the Greeks. In battle, Hector duels a warrior he believes to be Achilles and cuts his throat, but then takes his helmet off and sees it is Patroclus. Distraught, Hector finishes off Patroclus in a coup de grace, and both armies agree to stop fighting for the day. Achilles is informed of his cousin's death and vows revenge. Wary of Achilles, Hector shows his wife Andromache a secret tunnel beneath Troy. Should he die and the city fall, he instructs her to take their child and any survivors out of the city to Mount Ida. I just made myself sick a little bit because when I did that little ditty, that's from Avatar, The Last Airbender. You know what I think about that show.
Big fan.
Yeah. The next day, Achilles arrives outside Troy and challenges Hector. The two duel until Hector is killed and Achilles drags his corpse back to the Trojan beach. Priam sneaks into the camp and implores Achilles to return Hector's body for a proper funeral. Ashamed of his actions, Achilles agrees and allows Briseis to return to Troy with Priam, promising a 12-day truce so that Hector's funeral rites may be held in peace. He also orders his men to return home without him. Agamemnon declares that he will take Troy regardless of the cost. Concerned, Odysseus concocts a plan to infiltrate the city. He has the Greeks build a Trojan horse as a peace offering and abandon the Trojan beach, hiding their ships in a nearby cove. Priam orders the horse to be brought into the city. That night, Greeks hiding inside the horse emerge and open the city gates for the Greek army, commencing the sack of Troy. The soldiers of Troy attempt to defend the city, but they are overwhelmed and massacred, while also probably intoxicated because they're partying, and while most of the population is killed or taken as slaves. As the lower city is being sacked, Andromache and Helen guide the Trojans to safety through the tunnel. Helen is taken back to Greece, as FYI. Paris gives the sword of Troy to Aeneas, instructing him to protect the Trojans and find them a new home, which will, of course, become the Aeneid. As a Greek army penetrates the palace walls, Glaucus leads the remaining Trojan soldiers in a valiant defense of the palace. Trojans kill many Greeks, but are ultimately overwhelmed and killed. Agamemnon enters Troy's throne room, kills Priam from behind. The son of Achilles actually is the one who kills Priam, and captures Briseis, or recaptures, I should say, who then kills Agamemnon. Achilles fights his way through the city and reunites with Briseis. Paris, seeking to avenge his brother, shoots an arrow through Achilles' heel and then several into his body. Achilles bids farewell to Briseis while sniffing her hair and watches her flee with Paris before dying. In the aftermath, Troy is finally taken by the Greeks and a funeral is held for Achilles, where Odysseus personally cremates his body. Okay. Are you ready? Are you satisfied?
Very.
Okay. First question. Did you like it?
There are aspects of the production worthy of admiration, I would say, namely the costumes, Oscar nominated, and sets, the locations, the logistics. The script is a big problem, and for me personally, the star. Ultimately, there's just no winning me over with a historical take on the Trojan War, starring a real-life monster and half-terrible actor, even if executed well, which I think it is. So I would say no.
And that, friends, that's it for us. It was great to see you. Remember, you can like or subscribe. That's also 3 out of 3. So each time you come on this show, you don't like what I have to offer. I can't remember if I liked Jane. I think I was a bit iffy on it. I think I had some issues. I agreed with you on the other
opposite
sex.
Of sex.
Oh, is it? No, it's the other sex, isn't it?
I think the movie was called The Opposite of Sex for some reason.
Okay, but then we got it confused with The Opposite Sex, which is Christina Ricci.
Yeah, we should have watched that one.
Yeah. And here we are going to disagree because I love this film, which you knew that going in. I had told you that. I see his problems. It's one of those things where I definitely see his problems, but I think it is great in many areas. I was looking more closely at the costumes, especially since I had just rewatched Netflix's Fall of the City, and their costumes, while still, I think, elaborate, are their colors are sort of muted, and it feels like more grounded and realistic, where this is like so lavish. You see like the richness of everything. I guess script wise, some of the dialogue I really like. I felt like it was pulled from the Iliad, and I thought people had great things to say, whether it was delivered well or not, I don't know. But there were those moments, you know, when Briseis ends and says, you know, it would have been easier if you were a dumb brute. The things that he said leading up to that, I thought were very powerful about, you know, living in the moment, which is a very Epicurean philosophy, and you know, you will never be as beautiful as you are now in this moment, or the meeting between Priam and Achilles, and that. Yeah, so I personally, I guess it depends on, you know, script as you mean, perhaps overall, and how things are moving and action by action, or do you mean, did you have issues with dialogue?
Yeah, and it's
Okay.
something that I think both reviews brought up, which is that it's just very repetitive. To my ear, most of the
Okay.
character's dialogue was a simple reiteration of their motives, which were already pretty simple.
Yeah. With the repetition of being well known and fame. And I will say that, you know, in the source material, there is a lot of repetition too, but I can see that you have that opportunity with thousands of lines versus a 2.5 hour film where you can get across potentially twice. Because, yeah, if you start with Achilles, because that is his thing, right? Is he going to be well known? Or is he going to be forgotten? And to have that theme, how much you need to beat that in? Because it starts with the kid, it continues with his mother, and then, you know, he has to sort of keep repeating it over and over again.
He does it to everyone he meets.
He does do it. Yeah, I guess to just be clear about what his motivations are. Okay, so we'll get into it. I don't think I'll be able to convince Harry that he should like this, but I hope to convince listeners to give this a shot if you haven't already. And obviously, you know, I won't be glossing over its issues because I'll certainly talk about it. One issue I honestly have is the fact that there are no gods in this, which was something that was brought up previously. I mentioned a director saying he couldn't do it because how do you do that without the gods? Because that is a huge thing. And it's not only this idea of mortality and honor and reputation, but the theme that runs throughout also is this idea of fate versus free will and the gods controlling certain actions. So without that, you know, now, oh, the people are just in control. And we'll talk about there are some characters that I think they believe in the gods, but they don't necessarily follow them as much or have as much superstition, but they're just not physically here. What are your thoughts on that? And I will say there is an exception with Thetis, but do you know who Thetis is? Do you know who she was in the film?
Yeah, she was doing laundry at the riverbed.
Yes, she was making a necklace, you
Oh, was she?
disrespectful fool.
That was
Yeah, she
like
was
three
making a
hours
necklace for
ago.
him. Would you have known that that was like who that was without being told?
Oh, I think they say that's your mom.
Yeah, but no like background beyond that.
Well, the only thing I know about Achilles is that his mom dipped him in
Yeah.
the Lazarus pit by his Achilles heel.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So she is a sea nymph. So she is a goddess type. So she was there, but you can't even tell. Like she could just be a human and that sort of thing. And some prophecies come up that's repeated. We do have priest characters. We have Perseus. Apollo is repeatedly brought up. But yeah, what are your thoughts about not including them physically?
I think that takes a lot of the complexity out of the story, both dramatically and thematically. Over the course of this podcast, you've touched on the idea of fate. And without that, you have just these mortal characters acting, I would say, kind of strangely. I think we're just missing a lot of context, really.
I would agree because Agamemnon, that we can certainly talk about, seems just like an awful person. You know, if I were to call him the villain, I think I would be okay with that. And there's some things he does at sort of the provocation of Zeus, or you know, through a dream. And without it, you're just like, oh no, it's just him. He's acting on his own and doing all of that stuff. Yeah, and I miss some of these moments because I think without them, it sort of turns every character to their like baser selves almost, or glorifies them. I think it exposes them potentially more. For example, there was that critique about how Paris, and this is pretty in line with him anyways, he's about to lose that duel and he crawls to his brother. And that is in character, I would say. But in the actual work, Venus looks at, or Aphrodite looks at him and sweeps him away and you know, puts him in Helen's bedroom. And so you just kind of miss that. And of course, people are upset because he, the duel, that was disrespectful. But yeah, you just kind of miss some of those moments and you've got to portray it some other way, in which case it just shows that their character is worse, I think, than it typically was. But yeah, I do miss them. I guess it's just taking away that supernatural element. Do you think this was something that would not have resonated with viewers at the time?
Maybe. Certainly people were afraid of that. I mean, when you look at a lot of the movies or the genre films around that time, like X-Men and stuff, you had like, oh, they're wearing these ridiculous costumes that just look kind of bland. I know that was a big sticking point. And it wasn't really until like the late 2000s that we started getting into geek culture and Game of Thrones, and you could actually accept like dragons and stuff. So I think this at this time you just couldn't have anything supernatural.
And I am happy because that was certainly something that I was looking at when cast lists were being released for Christopher Nolan's upcoming Odyssey film, that there are, you know, I do see Athena. And I feel like with that, if you're going to have Calypso or Circe, it would be hard to not have, because, you know, that's a sort, both of them are sorceresses. Yeah, so to not have that would be crazy. But you just wonder what an Odyssey would have been like at that point in time. But I do remember that by Armando Sante. Do you remember him? And Isabella Rossellini. Yeah, I was just thinking, is there any Odyssey adaptation that doesn't have the gods? So I don't know why it's the Iliad that can get away with it.
Well, I think like a good example of how to do this would be The Northmen from a few years ago, where it's not sh like you're not sure whether the gods are real. It might just be a hallucination. I thought that was pretty effective.
Yeah, absolutely. I liked how they did it in Fall of the City, where they would be present and some very infrequently could the mortals actually see them, but it was more like they were around and you could see that they are, you know, giving their guidance to some of them. But you know, Apollo is called upon so many times in this film, and that I just feel like, man, he's not there. It's so crazy. And you know, didn't do the plague or anything like that. Two connections to that I think the supernatural still kind of goes through. And you mentioned Thetis dipping her son in the river Styx, that Achilles is shot through the ankle at the very end, but he was also hit with many arrows in his body. So it makes it seem like it was just the compounded injuries that killed him off. What are your thoughts about this? Was this Peterson, do you think, playing it safe, but still an homage to what happened?
Yeah, with the level of realism that they chose for this movie, it would have been hard to explain why he just died after getting shot there. It reminded me of the infamous scene in the American Godzilla movie, well, the first one, I guess, where Godzilla's like roaring and there's a car explosion and it looks like he's breathing fire. And it's like, well, you guys are making a movie. You can have him breathe fire if you want. But at this time, whether 1998 or 2004, yeah, people were just afraid to do that. Putting aside Lord of the Rings, I guess they didn't take the right lessons away. But with all of those arrows, speaking of, it does remind one of Boromir's death, but not nearly as emotionally powerful, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the final one is two characters that, yeah, I wrote in the question show a lack of belief, but it's more like they recognize, and he even says, Hector says, you know, I have three rules, love your woman, you know, honor your gods, dot, dot, dot. But he is like sarcastic or at times dismissive about the gods when around his father, because his father claps back at him a couple times. And I think Achilles is also somebody that has less of a regard for them. And I just wondered your thoughts about, choosing these two characters in particular to kind of show maybe that doubt.
They want a war. We will give them a war. I would match the best of Troy against the best of Greece any day.
The best of Greece outnumber the best of Troy 2-1.
So what do you suggest? We surrender our city. We allow the Greeks to slaughter our men, rape our wives.
I suggest diplomacy. The Greeks came here for one thing. Let's be honest, my friends. Trojans are now burning on the pyre because of one youthful indiscretion.
Glaucus, you have fought with me for 40 years. Can we win this war?
Our walls have never been breached. We have the finest archers in the world. And we have Hector, whose men would fight the shades of Tartarus if he commanded. Yes! We can win!
I spoke with two farmers today. They saw an eagle flying with a serpent clutched in its talons. This is a sign from Apollo. We will win a great victory tomorrow.
Bird signs. You want to plan a strategy based on bird signs?
Hector, show respect. When our Captolemus prophesied 4 years of drought, we dug deeper wells. The drought came, and we had water to drink. The high priest is a servant of the gods.
And I'm a servant of Troy. I've always honored the gods, Father, you know that. But today I fought a Greek who desecrated the statue of Apollo. Apollo didn't strike the man down. The gods won't fight this war for us.
There won't be a war. This is not a conflict of nations. It is a dispute between two men. And I don't want to see another Trojan die because of me.
Paris!
Tomorrow morning, I will challenge Menelaus for the right to Helen. The winner will take her home. The loser will burn before nightfall.
This one, I think, is just about making characters relatable to the audience. Paris also scorns the gods when he's looking at the Trojan horse. But yeah, just because most people in the American audience probably do not believe in the Greek gods. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, those two. And I will say that's like the one good thing that Paris did was tell his father to burn it.
Burn it.
And in the Aeneid, we, funnily enough, we just translated this section in the Aeneid because back book two is a flashback where Aeneas is talking about the fall of Troy, and this priest comes down and he's like, do not bring that into the city. Do you, trust the Greeks? We know Odysseus, and that's where the whole I don't trust Greeks even bearing gifts and all that. And I had to tell my students, this is where we get the don't look a gift horse in its mouth. And I'm like, oh, I didn't realize it. But then some bad, so there's this whole debate, do we bring it in, do we not bring it in? And the priest says that, and then he goes off and he's at his temple and he's sacrificing a bull, and these two snakes come in and kill him and his sons, and everyone's like, it's because he sinned against the horse. But that, I digress. But Paris saying don't bring it in, I'm like, well, that's the one good thing you did this whole film. But it's so interesting with Hector. I'm going to talk a lot about Hector, I think, and just how much I love him, which I think people who have listened to the show know how much I love Hector, because of how honorable he is and his devotion to his country and to his family, that you would think to have the third leg of that triumvirate of pietas, he would have the love of gods. So it's so interesting for him to have that, and then to pair those two together, because they're very much, I think, foils of one another, but to have this similarity between the two of them, right. I find really interesting. I can see it from Achilles, right? He wants to be someone who can control his own fate, and he has that choice to either live on forever and be forgotten or always be remembered. So I can see that. But Hector, I don't know, it seems like everything, especially with his upbringing, it seems a bit out of character.
Yeah. And Achilles, too. I mean, he practically puts himself on the level of God, so it makes sense in this movie.
Yeah, and that's why I think with Thetis, had you laid out that that was a goddess or, some sort of higher being, then we could have led him in a different direction. But if mm-hmm. she's just a normal everyday lady, then I guess he wouldn't have any sort of respect, you know, for the gods. Okay, so my questions kind of from those kind of go in a chronological order. And yeah, we begin at the beginning. And just this first scene, you know, what do we learn about Achilles as a character, Agamemnon as a character, and their relationship for the first scene? And do you feel like they stay consistent throughout the entire film?
I do. And I think that this one is interesting. Unfortunately, in this scene, we learn the only thing that we will learn about them, which is that Achilles is in a single-minded pursuit of glory, and that only partially aligns with Agamemnon's imperial ambitions. So the two men kind of need each other, but there is certainly no mutual respect.
Yes. I think the only thing I would add is just how much they despise each other.
Yeah.
I think Achilles, when he talks to Odysseus near the end, that you're the, he either says one of the only or the only Greek king that I respect. Mm. I think you can see potentially what he would look for in a leader. And I think you see it in him too, because I think he does love his men well. And I think because of that, they love him. But with Agamemnon, I think it's more fear and a lack of respect. I think Odysseus also loves people, which is, I think he came up with the Trojan horse, honestly, I think in a moment of desperation, in terms of this film, in a moment of desperation, because he was just thinking, oh my gosh, this man, Agamemnon, is just willing to sacrifice anybody to get what he wants. But Agamemnon just seems like a man without honor, which is, of course, something that Achilles accuses him of anyways. And I certainly see in Achilles' argument against him, which pops up a couple times, to go to your point of repetition, and something that is in the actual work of, you know, you have these kings that are sending people off, you know, to slaughter for their own gain. Where their own gain? Where are they? Sometimes they're in line with their people, and sometimes they are not. And yeah, so that's why, you know, I respect, you know, people like Julius Caesar, because, you know, he's with his men in battle. If he's, you know, a little ways off, he's not too far. But Agamemnon, I think he just is like commanding people, and that's it. And so Achilles brings up that point of like, you're just staying on the sidelines, and soldiers are doing everything for you. But I love how he sows this, discontent between the two of them and this hatred. And so because we're skipping a large amount of their issues between one another, I think starting it off immediately and just having it always brewing beneath the surface, I think is a good play.
It is hard, though, because it does make Achilles seem so aloof that you do have to kind of argue for whether or not he really likes his own men, because he's like really abandoned them in that first scene. He has to be called to the front, as one of the reviewers said, like a movie star coming out of the trailer. Do you think that Achilles would have preferred if it was more of a just war, like maybe a defense of the homeland?
I'm thinking in the context of this film, I would say yes, especially thinking about that conversation when Odysseus comes to him and he's talking about, you know, war and kings and their petty reasons to his cousin and trying to protect his cousin. I think if there was something at stake for him, it would matter more than whatever this is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting wrinkle. And I think it sets up his eventual character arc, which comes kind of late in the movie, but it is there.
Yeah. So then we switch scenes to this negotiation, this treaty making with Menelaus and Hector and Paris. And I found this interesting. I actually saw the director's scene where Hector grabs Paris's face and basically like threatens him. I thought, man, you should have used that. But we'll just look at this. This is why we can't talk about the director's cut. But in the theatrical cut, Hector has righteous indignation on the ship at Paris taking Helen. But from my perception of things, it does seem like he knows they're having an affair during peace talks, because there's a scene where he watches his brother follow Helen, and I think he knows. Do you feel like this reduces his authority in the matter?
Maybe. I can see where you're coming from, but I don't think he expected Paris to take the next step.
Yeah.
Especially later when he says that Paris, like, he does this a lot. Surely this is another, albeit risky, fling.
Yes, there is a lot of focus of Paris and all these sort of port in the storm situations that he seems to have. Which is why I don't know if he mentions Aphrodite at all, but I feel like, man, this guy really needs to give props to the goddess of love. But where is she? Yeah, it was just interesting that, oh man, he's so upset and quite rightly, and you know, I'm gonna turn this ship around. And I thought, man, you should have stopped him from walking up the stairs. This is bad. Helen speaks of her lack of freedom, which is something that I wonder if I noticed when I was first watching this way back when, but it was something that I really zoomed in on when I was watching Fall of the City and sort of contemplated how she could get out and maybe her motivations for going with Paris. Do you get a sense that she sees Paris as a way to free herself from a gilded cage, or does she really love him? What's your opinion on this matter?
I think it's a really interesting question, but I'm getting no interiority from Helen in this movie any more than anybody else. And it would be a simple fix too. We just need like one scene of her relationship with Menelaus, but we don't even know like what she was like, if she was unhappy. So I guess if we don't know that, but we do know that she goes along with Paris to Troy, perhaps it was more calculated. But I think the movie wants us to assume that their love is true. Unfortunately, a single sex scene is not going to convince me.
I know you need that. That was my argument with the TV series, is that I needed more time with them before them getting together. And, you know, we're told, oh, there were some dalliances leading up to that, but how did they even like do the first one? You know, how do you, I don't know, was it love at first sight? What was going on here? She saw him as an easy mark. Yeah, you can't really tell. And then throughout the film, when he's going off to war, she does seem distressed. So I like to think that, you know, it is love, but because she does speak of freedom, then I wonder why speak of that? Rather than of love. So I wonder why that speech would necessarily be in there. She doesn't have a child in this adaptation. Because she does, actually have a child, which complicates things. Perhaps they were trying to reduce maybe what she, like character flaws of her, because that's certainly like a negative point that is brought against her, that she would abandon her own child to go with Paris. So potentially they're getting rid of that or trying to make it less complex. Who knows?
They're coming for me. The wind is bringing them closer.
What if we left? Tonight. Right now. What if we went down to the stables, took two horses and left? Ride east. Keep riding.
And go where?
Away from here. I could hunt deer, rabbit. I could feed us.
But this is your home.
You left your home for me.
Sparta was never my home. My parents sent me there when I was 16 to marry Menelaus, but it was never my home.
We'll live off the land. No more palaces for us, no more servants. We don't need any of that.
And your family?
We'd be protecting my family. If we're not here, what need is there for war?
Menelaus won't give up. He'll track us to the end of the world.
He doesn't know these lands. I do. We can lose ourselves in a day.
No, you don't know Menelaus. You don't know his brother. They'll burn every house in Troy to find us. They'll never believe we've left. And even if they do, they'll burn it for spite.
Then I'll make it easy for him to find me. I'll walk right up to him and tell him you're mine.
You're very young, my love.
We're the same age.
You're younger than I ever was.
So then this big question, I've put it here in the first half, but do you feel like the war is Helen's fault?
Unambiguously.
Wait. I was waiting for you to like say no, but you just left it blank.
Now, what do you think of me for harboring such a belief?
Well, I always thought that you had some sexist / misogynist tendencies, and now they've like been proven on my own show.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
In college, a friend of mine related a morality tale from one of his classes. He said that the professor told this story about a woman who was trying to like cross a river or something, and she talked to the boatman and she talked to all these people, and they wouldn't help her. And so she goes on this like sketchy route and gets killed. And the question is, who's at fault? And everybody in the class was like, oh, it was the boatman, it was this person. But the gotcha is that the only person at fault was the killer. And I don't know that I necessarily agree with that. Certainly in the American legal system, we have things like accessory to murder, things like that. So questions like this are kind of frustrating, but also just very, open to debate. Certainly if you want to take a historical perspective, which somebody had done on one of the early episodes of this podcast, you wouldn't blame Archduke Ferdinand for World War I. And so my question is, where does this idea that the war is Helen's fault even come from?
Yeah. Okay. So you're not the first person on this show to ask, and you won't be the last. So one of my befuddlements has been people writing in to ask when has anyone ever blamed Helen? And I have said people have always blamed Helen. Where
Oh.
have you been? It has started in late antiquity, I would say. I mean, it's post Homer's time, because I think Homer, I don't even see that he or the characters in there blame him or blame her, sorry, because there are certain character speeches that talk about, like, this is over a woman. What are you talking about? So after him, and so adaptations, quote unquote, or continuations of the story, Virgil, there's a very, well, I say a famous scene, but there is a scene in book two where, which I think I'll get my students to translate. Aeneas, on his way back, because he decides that he's not going to listen to the specter of Hector, but go and fight and try to save the city. When his mother forces him back, he sees Helen cowering in a temple, and he's about to kill her and blames her for everything. So even far as far back as then, and Renaissance people, Shakespeare, really everyone blames her. I think there is a connection, if you think about it biblically, to Adam and Eve, where Eve is she's blamed for the coming of sin, for the fall of man. It's just something that has happened. I think it's this internalized misogyny that I think unintentionally may have happened, and it's just spiraled out of control. So that's where the question is really stemming from, because I know that people blame her. And so now I've tried to use this podcast to really investigate that question and see, is there any way that we can blame her? And even in the last episode, when I was really examining this idea that, okay, she's really feeling like she's trapped in this gilded cage with Menelaus, is Paris's way out, and is that a cause? Like, even then, I couldn't be like, no, because she sought freedom. That is not one person's freedom, is not something for a whole war to begin. So, does that give you enough background?
Yes, I mean, certainly I knew that this was a question, but I was just wondering, like, who was the first guy to ask it?
I don't know who the first one was, but we're talking about antiquity, early in
Yeah.
antiquity. Yeah.
Gosh. And so I guess it's just like, well, she's so beautiful that the agency was just sucked out of Paris. How could he not but take her back to Troy?
Yeah, was she? Do you think she has any agency in this film?
In this film,
Yeah.
I guess. I would imagine that she would feel comfortable refusing Paris if she didn't want to. But yeah, that certainly doesn't add up to culpability. Because I mean, especially since they frame it so much with and characters talk about this, that Agamemnon was just using Menelaus's anger as a pretext, and like it would have been anything. It was convenient for him that it was this.
Yeah, and I spoke about that earlier. Like, she is the scapegoat for this whole situation, which is why I think it's going on for forever and forever. People are called Helen, for certain things,
Yeah.
Cressida in terms of Shakespeare. But yeah, it's just lived on in pop culture, which is why I'm just so astounded when people are like, "What? This is the first time hearing of it." I like that she really wrestles with it, because I think that's a very human thing. Like, she feels lots of guilt and shame for what has happened. She feels like everything has been brought upon it. People are dying because of her, and she tries to flee. But then Hector is the one who stops her. Do you feel like she has any agency in that moment, or does Hector kind of force her hand and make her come back? Could she have still gotten away and returned herself?
Ooh, I don't know. I don't really remember that part, to be honest.
Oh yeah, she would. They Hector just had a really good scene with Andromache Key, and then he was leaving the room, and he saw someone in a hooded cloak running off and chasing after, and it's Helen. Yeah,
I think he was right that at that point it was too late.
Yeah, people. Yeah, what's done is done. The die is cast, as my good friend said. Well, thank you. Yeah, I don't think that this is her fault either. The gods aren't involved, because those are, I think, really the ones whose fault it is, if I'm going to be honest. But because the gods are not here, one could blame Paris, but really it was Agamemnon's his desire for imperial superiority, and as I mentioned in real life, that Troy was sitting on a very rich strait that was rich in mercantiles and trade and things like that. So it was a good way to do that. But hey, let's be romantic and be artists and blame it on the woman. Okay, yeah, thoughts on the Achilles and Patroclus relationship? So no queer baiting here at all. I don't think you can even squint and be like, oh, maybe there's some queer undertones there. I really think there's no quote-unquote no homo here. But what are your thoughts on their cousinly relationship?
Yeah, this is only a relationship on paper. We know that they're cousins and that Achilles is kind of a mentor figure. They're sparring in the early on in some ruins, which I guess would be like boxing in a burned down gym. And he tells him not to fight, which we'll discuss soon. It's not as compelling a relationship as if it were a romantic one. I can't really think of like any cinematic relationship between like cousins that I found like really amazing, but I don't know, maybe that's just my narrow thinking.
Do you feel like you learn enough and are with them enough that Patroclus's death hits strong
for Achilles?
For Achilles / for the audience, that you can feel that?
I mean, the spell was certainly not cast over me, but I'm trying to think if there was a sufficient, like, think quantitatively, and I suppose so. But I think the problem for Achilles is that he's just so single-minded, that I think it would have been truer to the character if, like Agamemnon, he just used this as an excuse to kill Hector, or to grab his glory.
Yeah, I would say the emotional impact is not there. There's not a lot of buy-in. I feel like when I was watching it this time, I thought, huh. And I think part of it is because it was dampened because, I just watched Fall of the City, just read Song of Achilles. So I've got all of this where, you're showing the beauty of this relationship and you're giving them screen time together. And yeah, it just wasn't there. I feel like maybe when I first saw it, I might have had more of a reaction, but I definitely felt like I was more of a shipper in 2004. And I was like, oh, Briseis and Achilles together. I know. Well, this was before my woke reawakening.
Oh, I see.
Or awakening. Yeah, where I realized actually that's not a good relationship because she's a camp wife / camp slave. Yeah, so I think there's not enough screen time to have that. And he seems more of like a bullying older brother.
Yeah.
To him, which goes into my next question about, is it right for Achilles to prevent Patroclus from fighting? Which is really when they storm the beach the first time, Patroclus wants to also storm the beach, and Achilles is like, no, plenty of people will die this time, and you'll have your time to fight. Well, they'll have yours to fight. Thoughts on this?
So you train him and you put him in the armor and you take him all the way across the ocean, and at the very last minute you say no. That's absolutely ridiculous. And a bit hypocritical coming from Achilles, whose only thing in life is that battle brings you glory. So why are you going to withhold that from your little buddy here?
Yeah, and ironically, Patroclus' death brings him glory. Do you feel like in that moment Achilles is scared to lose him? Do you think he's showing a great amount of love for him.
Yeah, I think you could argue that.
Yeah, that was an interesting scene to watch it this time and think, huh, yeah, why are you? Because I feel like, oh man, in terms of the culture at the time, to say no to somebody like that and to prevent them from accumulating kleos or arete, I feel like there'd be a lot of shame attached to that. If I were Patroclus, I'd be really upset. So, yeah. I just have a note here that it's clear to me the entire film how much Hector loves Troy. Does this, for you, did it become annoying because it was a refrain that you heard a lot? Or did you feel like this added well to his characterization?
I think I liked this. I mean, I really had no issue with the Hector character or Eric Bana's
Oh.
performance. I think that, as we'll maybe talk about later, I think Troy as a place needed to be better characterized, but certainly I think nationalism is something easy to understand.
Yeah, and often symbolized by his father Priam,
Right.
but just and you can see, I think, that tension. I think that Bana does a great job. I think that Hector is potentially the best character in this film, though I am consistently biased when it when it comes to terms with or it comes to Trojans. But this tension that he has between, you know, protecting his country and then being a father and a husband, I think, is really well portrayed. Though he didn't say goodbye to Andromache. I'm always sad about that because
Yeah.
she's like pretend sleeping in the bed and he just walks off.
Stefan Bro.
Sad. Yeah. So in the source material, there's of course Apollo sends a plague because one of Apollo's priests slash priestesses were taken. And so in order to get rid of this plague, they give Chryseis back, but he now deserves a war prize. And so Agamemnon just seemingly steals Briseis behind Achilles' back rather than that whole discussion taking place in front of Achilles. Do you feel like this change affects all the characters involved, including Achilles, Agamemnon, and Briseis? Or does this just seem like this is in line with what we set up in that first scene?
It certainly works as an accelerant between Achilles and Agamemnon, their deteriorating relationship. Achilles actually draws his sword in the tent, which I feel like is something that you can't do. I will say that it does slightly disrupt the scene where Priam visits the Greek camp. I know that's a famous scene in the source material. The dramatic purpose of it in this film is accomplished by Priam winning over Achilles and taking Hector's body back, but then it's also like, oh yeah, and take Roseburn too. It was just kind of awkward.
That she's been. Do you feel like Briseis has much of a an agency since we're on that topic, or a person apart from the men that are in her life?
No, especially since her very introduction is just about how much she loves her cousins.
Is a different cousinly love. I think that I feel this cousinly love better than Patroclus and Achilles.
I would agree, although I know how much you think about cousinly love in general, so I'm sure you could make the argument for Achilles and Patrocles if it fancied you.
Well, I'm more of the step siblings.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
That's that is more acceptable.
I do ask people frequently whether they would date their cousin.
I understand that. Well, I should say I don't understand that, but I know you do.
This is where it stems from. It all started in
Yeah.
2004 when I thought, huh,
Wow.
could you date your cousin? Yeah, I mean, I like Briseis mainly in terms of the shipping here and the romance. Again, I see the problematic nature of it, perhaps even more 2025 goggles than 2004. But looking at it now from an analytical lens, yeah, she doesn't have much of a character, does she? It's defined by worship to, you know, her god, who happens to be a man, and Achilles and Agamemnon in a short way, and then her cousins, as you said, yeah, which is unfortunate. But it seems so insidious is not the term. Like a snake. I mean, he's called a sack of wine, if you recall Achilles, you sack of wine. But Agamemnon doing that, like behind his back, I think seems even more dishonorable than having a discussion and having her taken away after people agree, you know, that he should get that war prize.
Yeah,
so that's oof, but really sowing those seeds of discontent for sure.
I think there's something interesting there about how much things are different on the front than they are back home. Like the rules of war change and things like this can happen certainly whenever an army invades or occupies a territory. Sexual assault will follow. We see that a lot nowadays with Russia, or hear a lot about it. But it also just makes me think about like just watching Rose Byrne in this 2004 movie. It's just like, we failed her like as an actress. Like we just didn't write roles for her. Yeah. So I think she kind of had to start doing it herself. And I think she's on the road to an Oscar nomination this year. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. To get to your point also, I mean, this is realistic in that there is a chain of command. I spoke of kind of just because I finished Ghost of Yote, you know, you kind of have this idea of the, remind me of the title, the main person. Who's the main person up top? Shogun. And then the Shogun has, you know, people underneath him, you know, and then you've got people and you. So Agamemnon is kind of the big man on top, right? This king. Mm-hmm. But there are these other kings, but they are underneath him and they're kind of their liege lords. Yeah. And yeah, so whatever he says goes, which is really so he could kind of do whatever he wants. But it just shows, I think, his lack of honor and everything he does mm-hmm. here, which I think they're just not pulling punches with who Agamemnon is.
Bad man.
Is Paris a dud?
Yes, though maybe a realistic one, I would say. We all identify with characters like Hector in this kind of movie, but I think one's imminent death might inspire less than ideal battlefield behavior. He still comes off pretty bad in this movie to the point where I kind of wonder why Orlando Bloom even wanted to play him. So interesting, almost against type, you would say.
Follow-up question. Why give a dud the Sword of Troy?
So yes, you had an answer already to this question. I guess because everybody else was dead and maybe because it's like a bloodline issue.
Yeah. Wasn't this given though before Hector died or was it? Oh, after? Was it? I think it was before his one-on-one combat.
Oh.
Because I think that Hector had to use that sword in order to kill Menelaus.
Mm.
Yeah, Hector is a dud. But I think written...
Paris is a dud.
Yeah, Paris is a dud. Not the city. I think that he is written in line with, you know, his original character. The big change, though, I will say, is the love that is shown between Hector and Paris, because there's a lot of resentment that Hector has towards Paris and really browbeats him in the original. But yeah, kind of sniveling and weak. But then he comes together at the end, you know, he's shooting his arrows, pulling a Legolas, shooting after this man multiple times, even though his cousin's yelling to stop.
Yeah.
What a man.
Couldn't hear her, I guess.
What a man. Yeah.
What a man.
Do you feel like Hector loses any or much honor by helping his brother and breaking that agreement? Or were things just already too stacked against an honorable match that it didn't matter which way it went?
Yeah, I think the latter. I think he was, you know, when they go low, I think Hector makes all the right moves in this movie in terms of maintaining honor, putting family over country. It was one of those, like, noble acts that's also brave, because it's like, yeah, it's pretty risky.
Yeah. I recently saw an interview. It was either Megan Thee Stallion or Nicki Minaj who said, you know, they go low, we take them to hell.
Wow. I guess it was not Nicki Minaj, because I think she came out as a big Trump / Elon fan.
Oh,
something like that.
Dear. Unfortunate. Okay. So we've gotten to it. This is what you were waiting for. This is the reason why you came on the show.
Ah.
The use of sex.
You know, I love sex scenes.
I know you do. Well, I want to talk about the use of it and what we saw. We did not. I'm interested in this director's cut, but for the theatrical, are the romances believable? We said no in terms of Paris and Helen. Do you feel like the romance between Briseis and Achilles is believable?
You know, I think that, like, if for people like in different cultures than ours, then like maybe you get caught. I mean, Stockholm syndrome is certainly a thing, and I think that like If no, because she was Trojan royalty, so it's not like she would just assume that, like, oh, this is the only option I have in life, so I might as well just go for it. I don't know. I don't know. This is one of the, this is like my least favorite thing in movies ever. It just makes me so uncomfortable. And so I guess I would just say, no, it was not believable, and I did not like it.
It's funny. Is it your least favorite thing in wartime films?
I don't know. I'm not really a big war movie
Oh,
guy.
okay.
I like Windtalkers. I think that should speak for. I don't know. I think that in order to sell a romance, you really need to be, it needs to be about the relationship rather than its climax, so to speak.
Yeah, pun intended or not. I was reminded of our discussion when I was playing Gosu Yote. Some geishas came up. Or, different people. And I was like,
Yeah.
what's going on? Like, we're in a really bad situation over here. What's happening? And we kind of had that discussion about, in these dire times. And of course, listeners to the show know that, many, many women were taken and were kept. They did become camp wives, though I kind of shudder at that term and disagree with it because it's not like it was consensual. They had children, with them. Maybe love developed. We can only hope that it
Right,
was
right.
as pleasant as it could be. I would say, so in my 20, 2004 lenses, loved this romance. As I was watching it this time, and there's like, I really do think that the conversation beforehand is great. And but then night comes. And so you think like that's resolved. The next day they'll have more conversations and it'll build. But it just jumps too many levels, looking at it now, because she's got a knife to his throat. And he's like, do it. Do it. And just like the Emperor Palpatine, do it, do it. And then he rolls her over, and then they proceed to have the sexy time. And I just feel like it escalates too fast. The other thing is, and this is whether you believe in, or what your stance on religion is or not. But because she was wholly devoted to, a priest of Apollo, she mentions the gods frequently. She talks about Apollo because he, Achilles desecrated that. I feel like she'd be kind of anti-Achilles because of that. There was a mention of her virginity, because all the boys are very sad. And yeah, I just feel like she might have held on, to that because it seemed like it was important to her. So like my 2025 brain kind of wars with what happened. Yeah, I just think there needed to be more screen time that didn't involve sex. But in the end, I don't know beyond being forced whether she would intentionally do that. And without Patroclus, because Patroclus in the source material is really like the softening force for everything. Because other t it's hard to relate to Achilles as Achilles is. Yeah, so those are all of my thoughts on this.
Now, I
So,
will say,
yes.
and you can call me a hypocrite,
Ooh.
but if this scenario was gender swapped,
Oh.
I'd be pretty into
That a man was a camp husband. And
it.
a camp slave.
We don't have to talk about that any further.
I was just trying to picture it in my mind's eye. Yeah, if I guess if it were an Amazon, like Penthesilea. Sorry, I'm still processing what that would look like. Okay. Yeah, I guess the other. I mean, do you think sex in general is you? There were three scenes, I guess we could kind of say two and a half. But do you think that it's used well? Did it even need to be in here?
My eyes always glaze over at sex scenes. I can't cite a single sex scene in a movie that I thought needed to be in it. And it's not like some puritanical, I just think that it just stops the action. It's like a bad musical sequence or a bad action scene. It's just like, this is not forwarding the plot. And I suppose it's supposed to be kind of a spectacle in itself, but certainly this movie did not have the discipline of, oh, I don't know, Lust Caution by Ang Lee or something. I wasn't, I didn't like it. My eyes were glazing.
Yeah, I feel like the only one that could have been worthwhile was, in fact, Paris and Helen, if we're citing that as kind of the source for everything. But again, there just was not enough lead up to have that be a believable romance.
Yeah.
And I guess if you want to see who Achilles is, then having that scene in the beginning works fine, I
That's
suppose.
fine. That wasn't really a sex scene, though.
No, there were just naked women there. And then, yeah, so This sounds like an interesting question that I will say. Obviously, the framework is I don't like that there to be sexual violence in films. But my question is, should there have been some sexual violence in this film to basically make it realistic to what it would have been like there? I don't like to dance around those issues if it's true, because we're romanticizing what really would have happened to Perseus. So we need to recognize that. Or do you think the illusion of it, which was really men passing Perseus back and forth before Achilles whacks him over a head with a pan of some sort. Oh no, he brands somebody. Yeah. Do you think that was enough?
Yeah, I understand how delicate this question is, because certainly neither of us would be asking to see the sexual violence. This is something that you and the good professor Carolyn Coca were talking about earlier, perhaps earlier this year, where I can't remember what the book was, but it was the one, I think it was like From Achilles' Perspective or something like that.
Song of Achilles.
Yeah, and that the author had found, who I think is a woman, had found like a good way to suggest things, but without softening it.
Yeah.
I think that that's probably harder to ride that line in film. So I think that, I don't know, as kind of lame maybe as it was in the movie, or cliche, I guess it was functional.
Yeah. I think for people who are not in the know, I wonder if it was enough to be like, oh yeah, this was a bad situation, you know, kind of thing.
Right.
Because, you know, the 2004 Stella didn't really think about, oh, this Perseus situation is not good, actually. The fact that I think Perseus is the only female in that entire camp that I see, I think, is an issue. Maybe having like more women walk around, not necessarily anything happening to them, but just to show that there is, you know, maybe sad looking women around, to show what that situation would have been like. But that's probably all
sense.
We would need. Yeah.
Are you hurt? To fight them, you have courage.
To fight back when people attack me. Dog has that kind of courage. I've known men like you my whole life.
No, you haven't.
You think you're so different from 1,000 others? Soldiers understand nothing but war. Peace confuses them.
And you hate these soldiers.
I pity them.
Trojan soldiers died trying to protect you. Perhaps they deserve more than your pity.
Why did you choose this life?
What life?
To be a great warrior.
I chose nothing. I was born, and this is what I am. And you? Why did you choose to love a god? I think you'll find the romance one-sided.
Do you enjoy provoking me?
Dedicated your life to the gods. Zeus, god of thunder. Athena, goddess of wisdom. You serve them.
Yes, of course.
And Ares, god of war, who blankets his bed with the skin of men he's killed?
All the gods are to be feared and respected.
I'll tell you a secret. Something they don't teach you in your temple. They envy us because we're mortal. Because any moment might be our last. Everything's more beautiful because we're doomed. You will never be lovelier than you are now. We will never be here again.
Brute. Could have forgiven a dumb brute.
Yeah, I had this. I think I was just like frustrated that at this point, where my question is, who even is Patroclus?
Just some guy.
Just does he even have a character?
Well, I mean, his primary dramatic purpose is to be killed and inspire Achilles. So You got to build up to that, but it's just like, yeah, unfortunately, I think that Achilles doesn't really consider. I mean, I can tell that they like each other and he likes Patroclus, but yeah, there needed to be more substance there and maybe a character arc. Who knows?
Yeah, perhaps I think Achilles was just too big, which maybe is what Brad Pitt was saying about being in the center of the screen. But I think there's too much
Yeah.
Achilles to not fit any Patroclus in there, because you do see some really great things of Patroclus in the source material, and he has this medicinal touch. I get, he helps people, and he is kind. He's one of the few characters that speaks kindly to women. But yeah, here he's just like he's just a hanger on of Achilles, and
A groupie.
which is unfortunate. Yeah.
Okay, performance, I think, by Garrett Hedlund, who's kind of a journeyman actor. I feel like, here's this good-looking, talented guy. He just never really found the role that made him. I mean, he was the lead in Tron Legacy. I feel like he was good in as the villain in Death Sentence, but like, movies around that time were just not really like star-making vehicles, I guess. So he was just some guy.
Was just some guy. Do you feel like this film makes a judgment about which side is just, or does it show a preference, like being pro-Trojan or pro-Greek, or do you feel like it's pretty objective?
I think the film wisely takes the perspective of Troy, as we're really not made to sympathize with the people who are invading in terms of like, we don't like the driver of the war, Agamemnon, and maybe we're indifferent to Menelaus. We can say his anger is justified, but obviously we see that he's being manipulated. And then Achilles doesn't care about Troy in particular. He just cares about using the war as a means to an end. And again, as mentioned earlier, I think that Troy itself could have been more of a character, as people often say, like, oh, the city is a character itself. But there's that weird scene towards the end, which I understand it's functioned dramatically, where Paris is kind of judging the people of Troy for celebrating around the Trojan horse, thinking that they had driven off the Greeks. But I think it would have made more sense to spend time making the city feel like a place full of like living people, in order to set up the fall of Troy, but I do think that overall the movie lands on the side of Troy.
Yeah, because when it falls, even though we can intuit that its citizens are being slaughtered, you don't see them. Like, you really are only, oh no, Hector was killed. Oh no, Priam was killed. They're like, you only are looking at its royalty. So I think, yeah, more scenes maybe with the people. I don't know how that would have worked necessarily. You would have had to have done like a Queen Marjorie situation in Game of Thrones, where she's, coming down and being with the common people. But yeah, what is Troy? Why is Hector so devoted to Troy? Unless Priam is Troy, in which case, maybe we're getting there more closely. Yeah, so I disagree with what Pitt says, that he is the hero, because that makes it seem like we're all rooting for him. I think we, if we were to root for one, I feel like it's Hector. I mean, with the exception of like after Hector is dead and Achilles, you're kind of rooting for Achilles to find and be with Briseis. But you're, yeah, I just think perhaps it's the acting, but I think that I would agree that it might lean, if we're not objective, it might lean pro-Trojan.
I mean, there's that interesting scene where after Patroclus is killed, Sean Bean is like, I think we've had enough for the day, and the two armies
Yeah.
part ways. I mean, it really is. This movie is a drama about like a handful of people with thousands of people in the background. Like, how does soldier number 457 feel about that? Like, he's all the way in the back being like, what's going on up there? Oh, we're going home? Why? It's just kind of weird like that. And when I think about war movies contemporaneous to Troy, like Black Hawk Down or something, like those movies had enormous casts. And I feel like there was an effort to try to get as many perspectives as possible. In terms of characterizing the city, my go-to is always the Watchmen comic book, where every once in a while you would have that refrain of the people around the newsstand, and when the city gets squidded at the end, those are the people who we see get killed. I don't know if that would have worked in this case, but like, yeah, we needed something, I think.
Yeah, and in the source material, everyone who gets killed has a name, and son of ... or where they were from. Though I always remark that those were still potentially leaders. Like, yeah, you don't necessarily think of the grunts as much, which is the issue, right? When you go into war, you're it's a lot of people that are fighting in this war. And I think a lot of people are forgotten, and just these nameless masses. And so we forget about them here, and more focus on the leading players, which is the issue. Mm. Yeah. Given what we've seen of Achilles' character in this film, is it believable that Priam could convince him to return Hector's body?
So this is something that's actually buoyed by the immediate qualities of a film, like close-up camera work, the choice of music, even whether to include it or not. And even the acting. I might not like Brad Pitt's performance in this movie, but I think he's fairly convincing here. But I think the question is, about believability and or if it's consistent. And I don't know, it's weird because I kind of like this scene, but I don't know that it necessarily works in the context that they've built up. Because it's like, all right, so we have Achilles dragging Hector's body away specifically to dishonor him and then returns him like 12 hours later out of shame. Like, is that a realistic thing for somebody to do? I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting that guilt and shame are brought up in the Wikipedia synopsis, whereas, as you're reading the source material, it very much is, or a great part of it is that Priam reminds Achilles of his own father.
Yeah.
And so there's, I think perhaps empathy and compassion and love there.
And alcohol.
So that's why. And alcohol, is that what you just said?
Yeah, don't they get drunk?
Oh, originally, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, there's a kind of a little quote-unquote feast, as much as you can have one in a wartime.
At a tent.
Yes. Yeah, so I think he softens in that way. But I would agree that I think this scene is great. It's one of those that I think there are a lot of great words spoken, in particular, I think, from Priam's side. But yeah, immediately, going in there and kissing his hands, and Achilles is like, "Who are you?" "I'm a man who has done something that no one has done before. Kiss mm-hmm. the hands of the man who murdered my son." Yeah, so a lot going for it. But yeah, because Achilles seems so, villainous and vindictive there. There are no agreements between lions and men when Hector tries to have that. And this is, true to form of he is just so beat up and angry about Patroclus. But it's just this through, like, we keep going back and back. And because we didn't believe Patroclus, it's like, is this a realistic reaction to the death of this kid that we didn't really get to see a relationship with? And then, whereas in the source material, you're like, he really is there. There's great love between them. Yes, this grief, even though it's super intense, maybe it's realistic. So it's hard because, we just made him into this really rough guy, and as soon as he walks in the tent and he starts to unsheathe, Briseis is crying because she knows that Hector is dead and all of that. So it's hard. I think knowing the source material is the only way I can get through it. Because I know that he softened because he mentions his father. And it is mentioned, your father, ... But otherwise it's like, I'm on the precipice of like believing that, he probably would turn that body over.
Yeah. And then the fact that we're even debating about like believability or realism is kind of like the movie is already defeated in that regard, because this is something that like a heightened tone or world could really smooth over, that we don't necessarily have to agree with what the characters are doing, but we just have to feel like it's like this is something that these characters would do, and I don't understand it, but like there's a logic to it. And in this case it's like, no, is Achilles realistic? Like he's
Yeah, his reactions and things like that, yeah.
Who are you? I have endured what no one on earth has endured before. I kiss the hands of the man who killed my son.
Priam? How did you get in here?
I know my own country better than the Greeks, I think.
You're a brave man. I could have your head on a spit in the blink of an eye.
You really think death frightens me now? I watched my eldest son die, watched you drag his body behind your chariot. Give him back to me. He deserves the honor of a proper burial, you know that. Give him to me.
He killed my cousin.
He thought it was you. How many cousins have you killed? How many sons and fathers and brothers and husbands? How many, brave Achilles? I knew your father. He died before his time. But he was lucky not to live long enough to see his son fall. You have taken everything from me. My eldest son, heir to my throne, defender of my kingdom. I cannot change what happened. It is the will of the gods. But give me this small mercy. I loved my boy from the moment he opened his eyes till the moment you closed them. Let me wash his body. Let me say the prayers. Let me place 2 coins on his eyes for the boatman.
If I let you walk out of here, if I let you take him, it doesn't change anything. You're still my enemy in the morning.
You're still my enemy tonight. But even enemies can show respect.
Leader questions. Do you feel like Achilles is a good leader? Agamemnon, Odysseus.
I think Achilles is an okay leader. Obviously, his people skills leave much to be desired as he strangles one of his henchmen. Oof. But he apologizes.
Yeah.
That makes it all better.
And he loved, ice I think cream. He kissed his forehead.
Yeah. And there's that scene where he's watching an early attempt at the siege from afar and being like, that's not right. So he's got a mind about him. He's tactical. Yeah. He observes. Odysseus, though, of course, I think is the better leader. I mean, he was called in to like play diplomat to even get Achilles on board. And as we see, he is much more of a clever man, more of a thinking guy.
Yeah, and I think he cares for people.
Yes.
The nameless masses. And Agamemnon, does he have any good leadership quality in him?
I don't think so. I don't know the backstory in general, and also in the context of this movie, but I would even believe it if I was told that he kind of inherited this army, that this was, you know, the massive Greek army built up of all these conquered people was something that had already happened, and he was just kind of the beneficiary.
I guess the only thing I could say about him is his, you know, manipulation of events, that he certainly capitalizes on things. He sees an opportunity and he strikes at it immediately. Mm-hmm. That's the positive thing. But you got to be careful of those people because they're the ones that'll stab you in the back.
Right. Like W.
I don't know. Did W stab someone in the back?
No.
Oh, okay. Odysseus, I agree with you. And then, because I think that's, he was just so distraught when Agamemnon mentioned those 400,000 Greeks that he would kill off.
Right.
Achilles, yeah, I think just his being beloved, I think, speaks highly, especially in terms of like wartime and a soldier being beloved. Because, you know, if it's a person, Joe Schmo off the street, that could be anything. But, yeah, I think something's got to speak to that about him, in my opinion.
Because
I think those people are willingly a part of it. Somebody called them mercenaries, maybe. But, so, you know, they're in it for the money and the booty. But, you know, I think they're also in it because they love their leader and they trust him.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on Briseis killing Agamemnon at the end? which did not happen in real life.
I think it's satisfying enough. I think that as mentioned, Agamemnon of course dies after the events of even this extended version of the story. So I guess you want to round out as many character arcs as possible, but like in retrospect, I think it is a little weird that the fall of Troy saw the deaths of not only Priam and Achilles, but Agamemnon in like a 5-minute span. It's like, wow, yeah, a lot of people died there.
Yeah, it's too bad, someone who I guess was at the heart of Troy didn't
Right.
kill him. And it was more like someone who was tangentially, related to that. But yeah, I think it maybe circles back to her attempting to maybe sort of kill Achilles and then finally being able to go through with it because it was
Right.
the neck and a knife. And it might have been the same knife, to be honest. Also, yeah, maybe finally blaming him is the issue behind everything. And so, even though Achilles killed Hector, this was all started by Agamemnon. So I think taking her revenge there, and also self-preservation, because he did say that he was going to bring her back home, which would have been
Right.
unfortunate.
And a bit of a parallel, maybe a ring composition to
Ooh.
the flight of Helen.
Oh, yeah.
Different circumstances, of course.
Indeed. Well, the last shot is Achilles dead with, an arrow sticking out of his heel and several broken arrows on the grass. And then Achilles is given funeral rites by Odysseus. And in the Iliad, it's Hector's funeral that really ends this. So, yeah, significance of Achilles being the one honored at the end and not Hector. Does this change your opinion of whether this is an objective slash pro-Trojan leaning film?
I don't know. This feels so disconnected from the whole movie. And it's really like one of the funny ironies where the character arc of Achilles is like him gradually becoming more human and caring less about glory and immortality. But in the end, it's like we will remember him forever. I think the only reason to change it from Hector's funeral to Achilles would be to make some kind of commentary on history being written by the winners. But I just didn't really sense any statement being made here, other than that the major players in the Trojan War, including Hector, were some pretty cool dudes. The end.
Yeah. And I guess how would they have done Hector's funeral rites if Troy was burned?
Right.
And you
Well,
could,
yeah.
yeah. And
He's
I,
just
you know,
there.
his funeral rites would have been beforehand, but yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and his that, his glory lived on because, Odysseus says something along the lines of let them say I lived in the time of kings and the time of, Hector and Achilles, etc. So I guess we get that final exclamation point of being remembered for always.
You got what you wanted.
Indeed. How new reader friendly is this film?
Yeah, there's a bit of a Star Wars pre-roll in the beginning. I think it gives you just enough upfront to help the audience understand what's going on.
Do you think of anyone who, like yourself, well, if you had no, as you say, by cultural osmosis, known some things about the Trojan Horse and the Trojan War, would you have fully grasped what was going on?
No, I mean, especially for a kid, like I didn't really understand what Troy was or like where Greece was probably, or what time period this movie was set in. Especially since we were watching all these movies back to back, like it really blurs with Kingdom of Heaven, especially because of Orlando Bloom. And even Lord of the Rings, which I think I had to ask my dad, like, was this based on a true story? So with Troy, yeah, I think I don't know. I mean, I feel like I would say that I think they do a pretty good job contextualizing it for the most part.
Would you understand the nuances of characters and like what's happening?
Yeah, oh, if only because they're so upfront and loud about character motivations.
Yeah, I think I mostly agree with you. I think maybe any exceptions might be the roles of women in this particular film, with Helen she's starting to get there when she's talking about her lack of freedom. But I think the Briseis, that romance is just completely, well, it's romanticized to be redundant. But, and you don't really get the understanding or the sense of what that would have really looked like and the ugliness of that. So I think that might be an issue. But I think broad strokes, they get the characters down okay, with the exception of Patrick Kluss. So I think you could hop in and be mostly okay. Were there any characters that we did not talk about? I was just thinking about Andromache. Anyone that you wanted to talk about that we didn't get to?
We didn't really talk about Priam, and he had a lot to say about Peter O'Toole, which is funny.
Oh, as the, yeah, a drunken fool.
I mean, he comes off so like stately and kind of convincing in this movie that I'm shocked to learn that he was such a menace behind the scenes. But I think that that is something pretty well known about Peter O'Toole. And I think, like, when it comes to like accents, the fact that he was so posh and British really helped. I suppose I would liken it to the show Chernobyl, where everybody had British accents. It's just kind of that, like, you just buy it. I don't know why Rose Byrne and Eric Bana had to not have Australian accents, or why nobody gets to have Australian accents in movies, TV shows. I liked his performance a lot.
And he, I think, encapsulates Priam to a great degree, and his love of the city, his love of his family, his kindness towards Helen, because he's another character that treats women well. Mm-hmm. There's that scene where he tells Helen to, you know, sit by me, ..
Yeah.
I think that might have been the Menelaus and Paris one-on-one. But yeah, I think that he does a good job. So I'll be interested to see accents, if any, are in Christopher Nolan's. Because what I saw with John Barenthal, who's one of the suitors, he's just speaking like John Barenthal.
Yeah, so love it.
Not really sure. And I don't remember. Yeah, because Telemachus would have been speaking. So it might be American. I don't think Tom Holland had an accent when he was talking to John Barenthal.
It's weird. What, I mean, do you want Matt Damon to have a Boston accent? Would that make it better?
Oh, could you imagine? And then floating by him on a raft is like a little donut hole that they forgot to edit out.
Like the Starbucks coffee cup.
Yeah, it was a product placement for Duncan. That'd be crazy. Anything to say about Andromache?
Yeah, I mean, I love Saffron Burroughs as an actress. I think that her character here was a little bit, not even underdeveloped, just underseen. Like, I feel like she was only in a couple of scenes.
Yeah, I think she really, her scenes with Bana are great. And I think she captures the character of Andromache well. I would have liked to have seen her interact with Helen. Again, maybe they just were not looking for complications, but to get a sense, would they go the route of there being resentment, or would it have been maybe more love and understanding between the two? Because they run off together and it seems like all is hunky-dory, even though one could blame the other for, you know, helping to kill her husband. So yeah, we don't get any of that. So it feels like we reduce some interpersonal conflict in lieu of other, you know, conflicts that go on.
Ajax, any thoughts there?
Oh, that big man?
The big
Ajax,
man.
Who even knows which Ajax it is, because there are two of them. He's okay. I mean, one of the Ajaxes used to run off and do things with Odysseus. They were kind of little partners in crime, and Diomedes would also be involved. So you don't get to see him too much. I do like huge brawn, you know, people from time to time, just like really destroying battlefields and then wondering, oh, how is this person going to get taken down? And having him go against Hector, I think, is really great.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I enjoyed him for a short screen time.
I would agree.
Okay, well, the second to last, the penultimate question. How does this film reflect the style at the time, as well as American cinematography and filmmaking? And I think you started to get at this, obviously, at the beginning 5 hours ago. about, you know, 2004, but how, you know, can you look at this and be like, oh yeah, that's an American film?
Right. Honestly, it's tough. Wolfgang Petersen obviously was making movies in the 80s and 90s, and I don't know that he even necessarily adapted his style to fit the 2000s, which, was very post MTV, fast cuts, shaky cam. And his movies tend to feel pretty like classical. I say this as a sort of Peterson scholar, but I think I've only seen Air Force One, and I remembered that he did Enemy Mine, which I really like that movie. But there's definitely a post Lord of the Rings, post Gladiator feel to these battles. And maybe that's just unavoidable, especially given that it's like a siege, and that was one of the most famous battles in Lord of the Rings. So it's a tough question. The cinematographer, as you mentioned, is an Englishman named Roger Pratt. He actually died last year, last December, at the age of 77, but he was a favorite of Terry Gilliam, having shot 12 Monkeys with Brad Pitt, The Fisher King, and one of the most notable visual movies ever, Brazil. And he also did the 89 Batman. So there you go.
Yeah, I just wonder. So yeah, because I did my Italian, looking at the Italian films, and yeah, there's such a focus, I think, on grandeur and set design, and I wonder is that same here? But I think here it's more like let's make things really, really big. Just these shots with so many people, and I feel like I'm thinking about Babylon. Do you remember some of those scenes, which of course is based off of actual, this transition between silent films to talkies and those battle scenes and everything, that I feel like that's maybe what makes up American filmmaking is just this, I don't know, this gross display of opulence and like how many extras can we get and how big can we make it? Whereas the Italian films that I was watching kind of focused in on smaller pieces and had care in how they were creating the set and things like that. That might just be, I feel like it would involve more study and analysis, but that's kind of the cursory that I would have. And there was more, I mean, obviously what I was watching was in the 60s and then there was a silent film, but this focus, I think, on sex, like we have to sex it up too, I think is more of an American standard. I mean, the Europeans do like sex, but I feel like it doesn't have to be in there as much as other ones. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't know if I was surprised to see it, maybe just bored. I mean, I it, this movie does feel kind of like old Hollywood in a way. I think I was just listening to the episode where you're talking with Tom, and he mentioned Ben-Hur,
Oh, yeah.
like that kind of movie, where like Yul Brynner is the pharaoh or something. So it's like, okay, Brad Pitt's gonna be Achilles. It's like, well, is he Greek? No, but he's going to be doing a British accent. Like, it's all just like stage dressing, and there's an artifice about it. That's kind of the charm. Like, I love movies that are shot on sets, to be honest. Like The Bride with White Hair is like one of the most visually interesting movies. But this movie really goes the opposite direction, as you say. It's just huge, and unfortunate. It's so unfortunate that it does feel so shallow, because of the characterization. I think that, to give the man his credit, David Benioff would see better success with Game of Thrones, sort of matching scope and scale with, actual depth. But yeah, in that regard, I think this one does feel like more of a dress rehearsal.
Then of course the final question is, do you feel like this, in your knowledge or your limited knowledge, does this follow the spirit or the law of the Iliad?
Yeah, I can't speak to the spirits of the Iliad, but certainly this one directly violates the law, I would say, with this like historical approach. And I just can't think of an example of a successful movie like this, that looks at the supposed real world events that might have inspired the great fictions. Like, there's the Legend of Hercules. I don't remember if that was one with the
Oh,
rock,
yeah.
in the Heart of the Sea with
Oh,
Thor.
yeah.
I think this is one genre that audiences just like seem to reject over and over again.
Alas. Yeah, I would say the spirit, given the two choices, I think broad strokes, it hits all the moments that you would expect. And characters, for the most part, unless you have to squint, are mostly accurate, I think. Just lack of believability with some relationships, but yeah, definitely not the law. And Menelaus getting killed off, Agamemnon getting killed off by Perseus, that was crazy. Harry, thank you so much for coming on, third time in a row.
And counting.
And, yeah, we'll see. We'll see. Where can people find and support you?
Thank you, Stella. You can find, if you enjoyed this for some reason, or at least my part in it, you can
Oh
find
my
me
gosh.
on my podcast, Questions We Don't Have Answers with Donovan Morgan Grant with Isis.com. It's a movie blog.
Did you also want to share your side hustle as Kim Jong-ho?
No.
Kim Jong-ho.
For exactly that reason. You don't take me seriously.
Every writer wants a theme song, and I have created one for you for free.
Wow. I mean, I will say that I had fun in Baltimore and we met a lot of, or I met a lot of fire and water people. Got to meet Tom. And yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Tom's not on this network, so that's okay. But
Oh,
Shag,
really? Yes, Shag. I mean, come on.
yeah,
The big man.
and Brett and Paul. But yeah, Tom's on the Two True Freaks. Yeah. So, okay.
Well, you can edit around that if you'd like.
No, that's okay. It's good to keep in people's mistakes. Yeah, I know. Well, I appreciate it. I think we're actually just under the running time of the theatrical release.
Oh my gosh. Well, I have a question for you.
Yes?
It seems like we're actually kind of eye to eye on this movie. Or at the very least, you are able to, or rather willing to talk about its flaws, which is not easy to do for a movie that you like. So I guess the question is like, is this one of those movies that, in the language of Stella, you are ashamed of, but not really ashamed of? A guilty
Ashamed
pleasure
of.
that you do not apologize for. I think that was it.
Yes, the background is so this guy's making fun of me because when I come to visit, and sometimes Donovan, we or I like to come up with themes of like, hey, you should bring a film that dot dot dot. And I think we've only done it twice. Once was a comfort film. And then this latest time was, yeah, a film that you're like somewhat, ashamed of, but you still love it. And so, yeah, I had brought Cruel Intentions. So I suppose so. I feel like I am less embarrassed to say that I love Troy than I love Cruel Intentions. So there might be like a spectrum of films that I'm, yeah. So, well, hey, this is definitely better than Set It Off.
Again, the movie is called Make It Happen.
It was so bad. I can't even remember what its name was. So,
No.
and that's saying something. Thank you again for your time. Thank you for watching this. Thanks for coming up with the idea to even have this episode happen. I mean, this
I
wouldn't
know.
even be going on for 10 hours if it weren't for you.
Right off the dome.
Yep. Okay, goodbye. Okay. Get out of here.
That's it.
Oh. If you would like to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network and prevent your dead body from being dragged around the city of Troy three times, go to our Patreon page at patreon.com/FWpodcast, where you can make a one-time or monthly contribution and unlock various rewards, including getting name-checked on this or any other network show of your choice. And perhaps you will be as loved as Patroclus. Support the network and harvest the good fruits. Be sure to subscribe to the show wherever podcasts can be found. Send questions or comments to backrolltheoracle@gmail.com. Don't question it. And follow the show at backrolltheoracle on Twitter. Thank you, dear listeners, for lending your ears to this show. And until next time, pray do read a book.